Welcome to WRAF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Peter and Jalene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jalene.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. Hi, Jalene.
Hello, Peter.
Usually we start off with some banter, but, there was a song, 40 years ago or so, called, what was it, The Eve of Destruction by Barry McGuire, and the first line was, "The Eastern World. It is exploding," although they were talking about the wars over there. Yeah. You want to read this one, or do you want me, you got that news item about the explosion?
I don't have it right in front of me.
Japanese officials say they believe a hydrogen explosion has occurred at Japan's stricken Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant, similar to an earlier one at a different unit in the facility. A massive column of smoke was seen belching from the plant's number 3 unit Monday. It's Monday there already. The reactor has been under emergency watch for a possible explosion as pressure built up there following a hydrogen blast Saturday in the facility's Unit 1. I mean,
so frightening.
It all is. I mean, beginning with something that there was no control over, the earthquake and the tsunami. And the Japanese prime minister said that this was the worst thing to hit Japan since World War II. And that's exactly what it looked like.
Yeah, definitely. Where
it looked like Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
I could barely even look at them.
I know. I think almost everyone has seen that. We're going to be talking about a lot of things tonight. And at any point, you would like to join me. And Jalene, please give us a call, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We'll get an email to us. The shorter the better, if you'd like to maybe have it read on the air. And we have a great Facebook, which is growing all the time. Great exchange. We have a little discussion panel there.
Yes.
And you can find out what's happening with the show and all of that. Some photographs of Jalene and me.
Yes.
I actually came up and not look. You always look good. But
I'm not so sure about that, but thank you.
But who was that great photographer? Oh, it was Jade.
It was Jade.
Who was on the air before
us. Listeners know who Jade is.
Yeah. And let's see. We have a team night call
The
other studio answering the phone at 313-298-WRIF. We have Aaron.
We have
Sarah.
And
Athena.
So thanks, everyone, for being
there. And actually someone else as well. But
we do?
Yeah. At least he was there.
Oh.
I don't know.
Okay.
Hello to him as
Surprise.
Well.
Surprise.
So,
yes.
What can we say about all this? But let me say something in general. We could be right at the leading edge of an era that will go down in American history.
I feel as though we're there.
Well, no one knew in 1930 or 1960s on the other end of it they were going to refer to it as the 1930s or the 1960s, that these sort of signal or watershed events in American history. I mean, the 1960s in many ways still shapes everything we think and do culturally.
Yes, in so many ways.
And in 1930s, of course, that politically has as well. I mean, that's what the conservatives are fighting against. Everything that was won by ordinary middle class and working class people in this country. That's what they're trying to undo. But we may have to come to a resolution of how money is spent, who has it and who doesn't, of war. I mean, think about, most of us don't think about the wars that continue, the drain on our budget, the destruction we're doing around the world, the casualties our troops are facing and suffer.
Yeah,
and,
it's amazing how we just hear less and less about that, but it never leaves my mind.
The president of Afghanistan, Karzai, said he wanted the U.S. and NATO allies to stop operations in his country.
Because I'm all for it there.
I think about it. The United States, like last year, United States troops killed 9 young boys who were collecting firewood. And there was this big apology from the United States. And naturally, our mind just goes to the senseless death of these young boys. They weren't even young men. They were young boys.
Yes.
They were 7, 9, 8 years old like that. And
for what, Peter?
One thinks about the grief of the parents, the anger of the villagers. And, you know, everybody suffers. There was some young man, probably maybe a young woman, probably a young man in a helicopter that got some information that those were Taliban. He pulled the trigger,
yeah.
And 9 young boys are dead. And he lives with that for the rest of his life.
Ugh.
I mean, maybe if you want to start putting rank order, if you want to order everything, who suffered the most? You know, the parents, the children, the village. All of that.
Mm-hmm.
But in that, but if instead of going 1, 2, 3, 4 like that, if you just kind of put it in a, what would you say, in a spread or a galaxy of suffering that doesn't have to be, they're in there at as well. They'll carry that memory with them to their grave.
And I mean, they should not have to.
Yeah. PTSD, I mean, that's what a prescription for that.
Yeah.
313-298-WRIF. Let's just talk a little though about that what's happening in Japan with those nukes. Now, there's not much you can do about earthquakes and tsunami, although the Japanese have done quite a bit, and we could talk about that in a while. In other words, they have strict regulations about buildings, so there wasn't
right.
an enormous amount of building collapse.
Building codes are what you're talking about,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And, you know, Harold, who listens to the show, said something about there are now 6 nuclear power plants in various states of breakdown in Japan.
That's right.
Okay, folks. You know, Peter, what we've been saying all these years, what we do in the event of things like this?
Uh-huh. There's a special way. There's instructions about
yeah,
you.
There's instructions. You
bend over, lift your leg, and kiss your ass goodbye.
Yeah, pretty much.
But all the training and warning, and they have a training in Japanese villages, towns, cities, everything, for what happens when there's an earthquake or a tsunami. Here they got like 15 minutes warning, and so there was no way whatsoever to deal with it. And no one knows when earthquakes are going to happen. It's an earthquake belt. It's an earthquake zone. And, wait a minute, I don't...
there was the one in 1995. The
killed 6,000 people.
6,000 right? Injured 26,000
yeah.
people.
And this, they're talking about, it's at least 10,000. You know, it could go much, much higher.
Yeah, I'm hearing 1,700 that they've confirmed, but I hear that that's the number.
Remember, I sent you this from the New York Times just yesterday. Crisis underscores fears about safety of nuclear energy. And I said, what did I write back? Oh, do you think?
Yeah, I would think it was a little stronger than that. But
the 2 reactors of the earthquake, now it's more than that, the damaged nuclear plant could be suffering meltdowns, underscores the Japanese nuclear industry's troubled history and years of grassroots objections from a people uniquely sensitive to the ravages of nuclear destruction. And, I mean, the irony of this.
No nukes, people. How many years have you been saying that, Peter? And, you know, we have a good friend who dedicates his life.
Harvey Wasserman?
Yes, to, the anti-nuclear power. I want to know, really, seriously, people, you can kiss your ass goodbye with this stuff. Why do people continue to support it? And if you do, I want to know why.
Well, very, very good question. Are there people out there that think, well, this is still a good idea? Frank Zappa, the Mothers of Invention, sang, I won't even try, it can't happen here.
Right.
Well, Kenneth, here, in this New York Times article, it says, critics of nuclear energy have long questioned the viability of nuclear power in earthquake-prone regions like Japan or California.
Yeah.
And if you go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, you can read an article there by Harvey Wasserman, our pal, who's often been on this show in the interviews that follow this. Japan's quake could have irradiated the entire U.S. And here's what he says. Had the massive 8.9 Richter scale earthquake that has just savaged Japan hit off the California coast, it could have ripped apart at least 4 coastal reactors and sent a lethal cloud of radiation across the entire United States.
Yeah, the reality is that it can happen. And this guy's no BS. I mean, this is what he does for a living.
I mean, who are the geniuses that put these huge reactors at San Onofre and Diablo Canyon, which they're not designated to withstand such powerful shocks. All 4 are extremely close to major earthquake faults.
Money, 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 money.
San Onofre sits between San Diego and Los Angeles. The radioactive cloud spewing from one or both reactors there would do incalculable damage to either or both urban areas before carrying over the rest of Southern and Central California. Now, here's the deal. Those plants were shut down in Japan before they started this meltdown and this hydrogen explosion. What happened at Chernobyl was twofold. One, it was operating at full power. And secondly, they didn't have a containment vessel. I think, I'm pretty sure these do. Diablo Canyon is at Avila Beach on the coast just west of San Luis Obispo between Los Angeles and San Francisco. A radioactive eruption there would pour into Central California and, depending on the winds, up to the Bay Area or southeast into Santa Barbara and then to Los Angeles. The cloud would at very least permanently destroy much of the region on which most Americans rely for their winter supply of fresh vegetables. Well, I mean, that's not the biggest concern.
Yeah, there's bigger concerns.
Yeah. So we have this source of energy that is supported by the elites, that is guaranteed by you and me through our taxpayer dollars. If it would have been left to the so-called free market, it never would have even been developed, because even 60, 70 years ago, the fear was so great on the part of the developers that they could stand liable for damages if there was an accident, that they had to get this, I forget the name of the act now, that the U.S. government guarantees I think it is in Harvey's, the Price-Anderson Act of 1957. And as it is, it is only covered up to $11 billion. He says a tiny fraction of the trillions of dollars worth of damage that could be done. So you've got this something that can only have one mistake, or all hell is to pay. But say this is all Chicken Little. Say our sky never falls, that we don't have any earthquakes in California.
Well, that's not going to happen.
Okay.
Hello.
And even if we do, they withstand all that and nothing happens. There is still, and we've talked about this numerous times, where do they put the radioactive waste that has to be kept secure for a quarter of a million years? They date human as we are, Homo sapiens. Sorry for you, some of you homophobes that are there. I didn't mean to excite you, but that's our species, Homo sapiens. We've been on the planet, depending now. I think they have it. They got it way backed up to 40,000 years when humans first started appearing on the planet as we know them today. So this stuff has to be kept a quarter of a million years. This is absolute insanity, folks. Does anybody out there want to say, oh, well, I think science will...
It's pretty safe. Yeah. Really. It's been proven that it's safe. Well, here's the deal. No, it's not.
And here's something. I was thinking, and this is in another regard, all of these protests that are going on in Madison and in Ohio and Indiana and now in Michigan.
Yes.
And stay tuned for this. We're going to be talking about what Governor Snyder, who is really just a Governor Scott Walker from Wisconsin, a Scott Walker in cheap
disguise,
clothing.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Peter's making me get up before noon because
we're going to go to that demonstration.
We're going to the demonstration Wednesday in Lansing, and we'll be talking about that. Yeah. I want to get up for this. How about that?
Yeah, and you can see all this, again, on my website, peterwerby.com. But this, it occurred to me, everything that is happening in Wisconsin, in Ohio, in Indiana, and these other states that are controlled by these Republicans that are trying to roll back everything that average people have gained over the last 50, 60 years affects the teabaggers as well. I mean, they're going to have 60 kids in their classes.
In a bad way, yes. Not in a good way, right?
Yeah. They think, all right, we're beating the Democrats. We're pushing back the liberals. We're destroying the unions. We're getting rid of NPR.
So dumb.
And your kid's going to go to school with 59 other kids.
I can't imagine. And the teachers, they're going to burn out. Yeah. So fast.
So
30's enough.
So there is some kind of blowback on this because regardless of political affiliation, there are a number of people say, wait a minute. We're not doing revenue sharing now. And so little cities all through Michigan aren't going to be getting money from the states like they had previously. But here is something particularly that you would think, unless these people are completely crazy. And I got to say, teabaggers.
They're tinging on it.
Yeah. I tend to think, prove me wrong. I tend to think you're really kind of crazy. I'm sorry. That sounds insulting.
Who did you?
The teabaggers.
Oh, the baggers.
The
baggers,
yeah.
Oh, well, yeah. Duh.
Yeah. But now, here's what I would think. Now, tell me if this makes any sense. The attorneys general, that's how you say it, the attorneys general, that's the plural, of New York, Connecticut, and Vermont have sued the Nuclear Regulatory Commission last Tuesday, challenging a new commission policy stating that nuclear waste can be safely stored at a nuclear power plant for 60 years after a reactor goes out of service. All right? They say the storage of nuclear waste remains a nagging issue for the federal government after years of work by the Energy Department to prepare Yucca Mountain in Nevada as a permanent repository for the waste. The Obama administration in 2009 ruled out using that state. State utility regulators have challenged that decision in a lawsuit. I thought they were all against Yucca Mountain, including the Republicans. But anyway, okay.
So well, of course not.
So the federal government is going to overrule the states, but it's even worse. The NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, on Thursday rejected all challenges to extending the operating license of the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant in setting up a confrontation between the reactor's owners and the Vermont legislature, which has blocked the state certificate needed to keep the plant running. So, in other words, the state wants to shut down this nuclear plant, which I think is like another one of these babies that is 40 years old. And we mentioned Harvey Wasserman.
Yes.
And that's where he, what do you do with your teeth? Ground his teeth or cut his teeth? Cut his teeth.
Cut his teeth. Right,
yeah,
sure.
Where he cut his teeth, the protests against this Vermont Yankee. The commission voted 4-0 to allow its staff to issue the renewal. In Vermont, environmentalism runs strong. How about common sense? Why is that environmentalism? And the plant has long been viewed with suspicion. Now get this. A series of problems, including the collapse of a wooden cooling tower in 2007. Well, a big deal. How about this? Leaks of tritium from underground pipes and denials by utility executives that there were such pipes made the plant wildly unpopular. All power plants in Vermont must have a certificate. State lawmakers then passed a measure forbidding the state's Public Service Board from issuing such a certificate without the approval of the House and Senate. Last year, the Senate voted 26-4 against issuing such a certificate. So, all you states writers, all you teabaggers.
Don't tread on me.
Yeah, come on. Stand up for that. But they are so nuts, they're going to say, no, the liberals all. They're against nuclear power, so we're for it. And, of course, you know, can't happen here. We're in this favored place. You know, it's been cold all winter, but we're not getting 5 feet of snow total like they got in Boston.
Sure.
We get maybe a tornado once every 4 years. Yeah. But, you know, hurricanes, no earthquakes, no tsunamis. But we do have a couple of things near us. One is called Fermi 2.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's
down in Monroe,
delight.
The home of Fermi 1 and 2, and also General George Custer.
And the one that also, I know someone who inspected those places and said, be afraid.
Well, I don't like the idea of a nuclear plant being near the birthplace of General George Custer.
I always forget to tie those two together. Okay.
And then there's another one near Toledo called Davis-Bessey. And as many as 16 critical parts of the Davis-Bessey reactor lid are cracked or flawed. This is from the Toledo Blade. Actually, I'm sorry. It's from cleveland.com. The reactor lid at Davis-Bessey are cracked or flawed, and the problem could get worse. And this was an article from a year ago. Engineers expect to find additional problems when they conduct a third round of high-tech inspections in the coming week. The cracks can lead to radioactive coolant seeping into the reactor lid, corroding it, and ultimately leaking into the heavily walled building containing the reactor. That's what happened to Davis-Bessey in 2002. So, and right now, Davis-Bessey is up for relicensing. So,
yeah.
My favorite quote from E.E. Cummings, the American poet, I don't want to frighten you, but they mean to kill us all. Our fates are in the hands of these maniacs that are solely driven by profit. They'll make up any sort of lies to justify all this. They must believe it because they're living on the same planet we are. I mean, if they live in Toledo or Cleveland and Davis-Bessey goes Chernobyl, they're going to eat it just as, and their families just as much as anyone else, right? I don't get it. I never did get it. Anybody want to call and defend nuclear power?
It's ignorance. I can't come up with anything more.
313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan with you. Now, on the political scene, of course, now that the Republicans have successfully broken the law, essentially, and passed these anti-union bills in Wisconsin. Yeah. And remember, all the unions said, and I don't even agree with this, all the unions said, we will accept the cutbacks, we will pay more for our health care. There's the budget thing you wanted. Breaking the unions had nothing to do with any budgetary concerns. It's part of the long-range Republican plans motivated and paid for by these billionaires like the Koch brothers, K-O-C-H. If you're hearing this for the first time, either go to my website, peterwerby.com, or just K-O-C-H brothers and check out these guys. They're writing the checks.
Their goal is to break all of them.
Yeah, because what essentially they want to do is to... They want no regulations. I want to talk about regulations and how needed they are under capitalism. Because without regulations, without capitalism being strictly regulated, what happens? Well, we have big financial meltdowns because they were set loose by the Reaganomics beginning, you know, the assault began 30 years ago. And without strict regulations, people would never, like in Japan, put up any kind of building codes that are necessary. But what is happening in Michigan could make what is happening in Wisconsin pale in comparison. If you can imagine that. I mean, what we saw there this weekend, the police said there was 85 to 100,000 people in Madison protesting against this backdoor maneuver that finally allowed the Republican-dominated legislature and the Republican governor to essentially abolish trade unions, which may turn out to be illegal, by the way. So there's lots of other deals. Some of the people there, and some of the reports that there was as many as 300,000 people in Madison. But let's just go the lowball, all right? Because some people say, you're always exaggerating. Okay, we won't exaggerate. We'll say
no. The media is actually always giving us lower numbers.
Yeah. I asked a bunch of people. I said, did you see anything about this demonstration in the major media that up towards 100,000 people, maybe three times that amount were there? No, no one saw it.
Someone got a hold of the media. One of these Koch brothers has paid someone off.
Do you think it's venal, huh?
Yeah.
Well, you get 85,000 ordinary people that are trying to fight for the rights of everybody in the middle class and the working class. They get ignored. You have 850 teabaggers get together, and they put it on the front page. And what I'm always pleased to say, there was more than 800, I'm sure there was more than 850 people waiting in the porta-johns in Madison.
And then cleaning up after themselves in the Capitol building.
Now, there's going to be a big demonstration in Lansing, as Jalene just said earlier. It's Wednesday, this coming Wednesday. And I know probably a lot of you work. If you can get up there, particularly if you're
in different hours like we do.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be noon at the Capitol building on Wednesday. Jalene and I will be there. We'll look for you. Go to our Facebook page.
Yes. We'll try to see look just like that.
And I want to hear a lot of, hey, Pete, hey, Jalene. You know? But what I want, so what is this Governor Snyder? Self-proclaimed nerd. Yeah. What is he up to? And because, gee, he says, I want to cooperate with the unions and all this. I want to play better than me because Rachel Maddow, like everybody else on television, has big prompter screens. They have this investigative staff and all that. I could do it, but I'm going to let her do it. So hang on. We are going to play just a little bit from this.
I haven't heard this, so I'm looking forward to
it. Oh, man, this is absolutely incredible.
Great.
It actually features, and we're not going to get to that, Naomi Klein, who has written a book called Shock Capitalism. Is that right?
Shock Doctrine.
Shock Doctrine. Yeah, it's about shock capitalism, how when there are natural disasters or economic disasters that it's used to, rather than figure, we got to do more to help the people, it goes the other way. We've got to do more to help
corrupt.
The rich. All right, so here is, I hope that, you know, I have a feeling this might jump to like a minute into it. But anyway, this is Rachel Maddow, I think on Thursday. And you're listening to WRIF, so hang on, we'll be right back.
The Michigan House has already passed, and the Michigan Senate is about to pass a bill that sounds like it is out of a dystopian leftist novel from the future. If you think that Republican governors around the country are using fiscal crisis as a pretext to do stuff they otherwise want to do, this is something I don't think I ever would have believed Republicans even wanted to do. But this is what they're proposing. This hasn't really gotten much national attention, but please just check this out. Governor Rick Snyder's budget in Michigan is expected to cut aid to cities and towns so much that a lot of cities and towns in Michigan are expected to be in dire financial straits. Right now, Governor Snyder is pushing a bill that would give himself Governor Snyder and his administration the power to declare any town or school district to be in a financial emergency. If a town was declared by the governor and his administration to be in a financial emergency, they would get to put somebody in charge of that town. And they want to give that emergency manager they've just put in charge of the town the power to, quote, reject, modify, or terminate any contracts the town may have entered into, including any collective bargaining agreements. So this emergency person who gets put in charge of a town deemed to be in financial crisis by the governor's administration, this emergency person gets to strip the town of union rights unilaterally by their own personal authority. But this emergency person also gets the power under this bill to suspend or dismiss elected officials. Think about that for a second. Doesn't matter who you voted for in Michigan. Doesn't matter who you elected, your elected local government can be dismissed at will. The emergency person sent in by the Rick Snyder administration could recommend that a school district be absorbed into another school district. That emergency person is also granted power specifically to disincorporate or dissolve entire city governments. What year was your town founded? Does it say so, like on the town border as you drive into your town? Does it say what year your town was founded? What did your town's founding fathers and founding mothers have to go through in order to incorporate your town? Republicans in Michigan want to be able to unilaterally abolish your town and disincorporate it, regardless of what you as a resident of that town think about it. You don't even have the right to express an opinion about it through your locally elected officials who represent you, because the Republicans in Michigan say they reserve the right to dismiss your measly elected officials and to do what they want instead because they know best. The version of this bill that passed the Republican-controlled Michigan House said it was fine for this emergency power to declare a fiscal emergency, invoking all of these extreme powers. It was fine for that power to be held by a corporation. So swathes of Michigan could, at the governor's disposal, be handed over to the discretion of a company. You still want your town to exist? Take it up with the board of directors of this corporation that will be overseeing your future now. Or rather, don't take it up with them. Frankly, they're not interested. Instead of thinking of Michigan as the upper and lower peninsula, let's just consider the prospect of Amway Stan, right? The area between Pontiac and Flint.
Oh, boy.
Could be a nice Dow Chemicalville, maybe. The power to overrule and suspend elected government justified by a financial emergency. Oh, and how do you know when you're in a financial emergency? Because the governor tells you you're in a financial emergency. Or a company he hires to do so does that instead. The Senate version of the bill in Michigan says it has to be humans declaring your fiscal emergency. The House bill says a firm can do that just as well. This is about a lot of things. This is not about a budget. This is using or fabricating crisis to push for an agenda you'd never be able to sell under normal circumstances. And so you have to convince everyone that these are not normal circumstances. These are desperate circumstances, and your desperate measures are therefore somehow required. What this is has a name. It is called shock doctrine. Joining us now is Naomi.
There you go. That's Rachel Maddow. If that didn't blow your mind, and you know what that is, of course, that's corporatism. And the other more commonly known description of corporatism is fascism. One man rule, everything turned over to the corporation. And let me just give you an example. I happen to know the man who is the mayor of Oak Park, Michigan, just down the road from us here at WRIF. His name, the mayor is Jerry Naftali. He's been a mayor for a long time. I think he's the longest serving mayor in southeast Michigan. Really cares about the city. You know, these city governments, the mayor gets like $6,000 or $7,000 a year. The city manager will get like maybe $125,000 or something like that. But Jerry Naftali is a real hands-on guy, really cares about the city, and that's exactly what Oak Park is facing. They are facing a cutback in revenue sharing, engineered by the Republicans, so that there will be a financial crisis in Oak Park. So under what these Republicans want, or in your town, wherever you are, whether you're in Taylor or St. Clair Shores or wherever, probably would be in towns controlled by Democrats, I would suggest. They can dismiss the elected officials. That is fascism.
It sure is.
They can destroy all the unions, and that is the goal worldwide of the fascist right. That has been the goal of fascism throughout the entire 20th century, destroy unions of working people. at the behest of the big corporations. It's a psychopathology that is expressed by the ground troops, because obviously there's not enough corporate heads and flunkies and what have you. So they need cannon fodder. They need stooges for the rich. And if this doesn't scare the hell out of you, and Rachel Maddow, she's not into any conspiracy stuff. This is a real bill. And that's why Jalene and I are going to Lansing on Wednesday at noon in front of the Capitol to make some Wisconsin-like noise.
Yeah, not just us. We're joining a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, we should tell you. It won't be just sure.
It's not just going to be us with our signs.
Yeah, I should have said that. This is called by the state AFL-CIO.
Right.
Thank you, Jalene.
Peter, Michael wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and this was about 10 minutes before you played that, and he said he'd like to ask just how close to fascism is the United States on a scale from 1 to 10 following the passing of the Emergency Financial Manager Bill in Lansing.
Yeah, and this is interesting. This is not going to be the type of fascism that's marked by race. Already, one of the things about fascism is the celebration of war and warriors. I mean, that's another element. There's somewhere or other online, it's called the 14 points of fascism, that's actually narrated by our colleague Mike Malloy,
which is worth
taking a look at.
Yeah.
But you know, they're not going to run people into jails. They're not going to have gas chambers. They're not going to have parades of black-shirted or brown-shirted shock troops or anything like that. They just want to kick our ass down to some third-world level. And not all of us. A third of us may make the cut, right? Because you got to have some level of consumerism.
Well, they need people to work for them, right?
The other two-thirds, Guatemala. That's
right.
What it's going to look like, if any of you have been there. So if this doesn't move you into action, if self-preservation doesn't, this is nothing about helping other people. This is not even really about supporting the unions as some historic, traditional, good institution in America. This is about defending your city. This is about defending your family. This is about defending our future. And unless we're going to let it be defined by these people that are nothing but ground troops for these corporations that want no regulations and want to make it more profit than they're making now. All right. Let me get your opinion on all that. By the way, did I say that is on my website, Peter Werbe.
Oh, good.
Werbe.com. PeterWerbe.com. Make that go viral. I think it already is. If you don't have a computer, and I know some of you don't, go to a library. This may be the most important warning that we have ever received.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werbe and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
We take you now to Riff's Behind the Microphone event with Specs Howard School of Media Arts.
Hey, man, how are you? Surprised to see you here.
Yeah, well, I'm in between jobs right now, so I thought I'd come out and see what this radio school is all about.
You mean Specs Howard?
Yeah.
I guess a lot of Riff DJs went to Specs, but it's not just a radio school. I'm here to learn more about their digital media arts program.
No kidding. What's that all about?
Learning how to produce videos and build websites. I could do it at Specs because classes meet on campus just 2 days a week, and part of the program's online.
Now that's a schedule I could handle.
You should look into their graphic design program. With all the sketching you do, it'd be right up your alley.
I'm glad I decided to look into Specs. I've got a lot more options there than I thought. Plus, my man Slayer's a grad there.
Now that you mention it, you do have a voice for radio. Maybe you should go with that.
More than just a radio school, it's Specs Howard School of Media Arts. Check them out at specshoward.edu or call 866-61-SPECS. Make your life
anything but ordinary.
The only gentleman's club that plays all rock and roll is the only place you need to be. Centerfold Lounge. $4 drink specials from 8 to 11, Detroit's hottest ladies, and the best party in town. Why go anywhere else? Centerfold Lounge. Open and rockin' 7 days a week starting at 2 p.m., Sundays at 8 p.m. Nobody beats Centerfold's frequent shots and bomb specials called by their rockin' DJs. Centerfold! On John R., one block south of 8 Mile Road.
All right, sir, your new tires are all installed.
And how much do I owe you?
Let's see, 4 all-weather radials plus balance, alignment, and labor brings your total to $0.
Did you say zero?
Yep, it's free.
Thank you. From the bottom of my wallet.
Free is better. Do your simple federal return for free at TurboTax.com. It's free to prepare, free to print, and free to e-file. No wonder TurboTax is the most trusted brand of tax software in America. Visit TurboTax.com today. Trusted brand claim based on Intuit Commission Survey, August 2010.
And now, here's another tax tip from TurboTax. First-time home buyers get a lot of credit this year, up to $8,000 in tax credits, that is. But remember, this credit only applies to home purchases made before April 30th. Of course, if you didn't buy a new home, you can still deduct your property taxes, mortgage interest, and even home equity loan interest. For a complete list of deductions and credits, and to find out more about how TurboTax can help you get the maximum refund you deserve, visit us online at TurboTax.com.
Hey, it's Meltdown. Join me on St. Patrick's Day at Rosie O'Grady's in Chesterfield. Score beads, limited edition Riff St. Patty's Day t-shirts, and great prizes from the Riff's Pot of Gold. Get your green on this Thursday from 3 until 7 p.m. at Rosie O'Grady's, 23 Mile in Chesterfield with 101 WRIF.
The Riff. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back. Thanks to all of you on hold for, you know, for being so patient.
Yeah, because, you know, what you have to say is important to us. So
but we had to.
We had to rave a little bit.
Yeah.
Now,
well,
also, we were talking about fascism here. someone brought that up. You brought it up. And on a scale of 1 to 10, Al says we're an 11 here in the United States. And that's Al, loud and clear in Rochester, New York. So thanks a lot for listening.
Well, you know, we're not, because there's an opposition press. There's radio shows like this.
Yes.
But they're so confident of their power that they can, they just think we're little squeaks. They don't care. Yeah, so they say eat the rich. You know, like this. Eat the rich. They don't care. Yeah, play it in the middle of the night. Who gives a damn? You know, because we got the money.
That's right.
Yeah. Anyway, what Jolene and I and thousands of other people, ordinary citizens, union members, non-union people, are going to be meeting up in Lansing at noon on Wednesday in front of the Capitol building to say no to the governor of Michigan. I can't ever think of his first name.
Rick.
Yeah, Rick Snyder, who wants to sign a bill that would give these emergency financial managers the power to throw out a local government.
To pretty much take over your city.
Take over your city.
Whatever one they want.
Yeah, this is...
This is 1984.
I got to take this guy first, just because, is he really calling from Thailand? Jeff, hi, you're on the air. You're calling from Thailand?
Yes, I am.
Wow.
Wow. Come on. Where? Name two cities in Thailand.
I'm in Rayong right now.
Okay.
And I guess,
I believe him.
Well, I'm a little bit far from Bangkok. You get to be in Bangkok and just past Pattaya in Rayong. So,
all right.
I'm actually from Windsor.
Yeah.
So I listen to your show quite a bit. Live in Japan.
Wow.
So I was calling to comment just to sit on the earthquake and how things affected my friends there.
Sure.
But after listening to the show, I've got so much to say. Just to let everyone know, I guess, you know, the north of Japan is the part that's been hit the worst, as everybody's seen on TV. It's Monday morning in Tokyo now. Some of my friends managed to get to work. Other people can't because of these power blackouts that are being enforced by the government. So some trains are actually stopped, and this is because of the nuclear power plants are down.
Right. And another one just exploded. Did you hear that?
Yeah. I've been watching the news here. And you know, like, I don't know that much about nuclear power and about safety. Of course, you know, I'm always worried because there are several plants in Japan, and we do get a lot of earthquakes. We feel earthquakes all the time. But I would like to say, you know, I feel a little bit safer in Japan compared to the infrastructure that I see in the States and Canada.
Yeah, I forgot about the one Ken Cardine, right, up on Lake Huron in Ontario.
Yeah, that's right. You're right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Or Ken Cardine. What is it?
Yeah, Ken Cardine, I think.
Ken Cardine.
It's old. It's very old. And I think, you know, when you go, I think, well, I guess one of the, you know, the one thing I wanted to say about that was I just feel bad for everyone there, and I'm glad I missed it. I'm just kind of on a extended vacation here, so.
So it, where you live it was affected?
Well, I'm sure there's some broken dishes in my apartment and everything. Yeah. Tokyo got hit hard. I mean, I've been there for 20 years, and, you know, people, we feel earthquakes a lot, but everyone said this one was different. It was very scary.
Oh, yeah, you've probably seen the films. It just went on and on and on. Usually it's a few seconds, and that's enough to rip everything.
To rattle you for life, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So,
so I'm hoping, you know, I mean, if we have a few dishes broken or whatever, it's not a big deal. But hopefully the building's okay. We're on the 11th floor, so I'm a little bit worried. But,
wow. So are you just calling on a cell phone, or is this Skype?
I'm on Skype.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You, the hotel.
Jalene is wondering, how did I know it was
Peter,
Skype?
Peter, you're so here and now. What?
Well, I could tell because whenever I hear like these CNN reports or something like that,
Skype them in.
It has that sound to it. Yeah, yeah. So it's pretty good.
Great. The internet's great. I tell you.
So
I can listen to your show.
So yeah, that's great, Jeff. When are you going back to Japan, or are you?
Yeah, we're going. We're going to go back. My girlfriend's actually here working, so we're going to go back in the beginning of May.
Okay. Hopefully.
Well, not for a while.
Hopefully things. Here's the scary part, this is not the scary part. This is, the scary part is what's going on now. Here is a depressing fact. They say this could just rip the ground out from under Japan financially. It's been kind of limping along for the last 20 years, and the kind of intense structural damage, that experience could just really send the economy for a loop.
Yeah, it's you know, I mean, Japan, you don't feel it so much in Tokyo. Tokyo's the capital. Tokyo's where all the people are. It's where all the people come. And you never feel a sense of recession in Tokyo. When you go outside, though, when you go outside of Tokyo, you see these places where the main streets are just, you know, half the shops are shut down, and it's a very depressed economy. And I think a lot of the places, Sendai City actually has a lot of universities. You know, it's a college town in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But the smaller towns that were hit hard by the tsunami and that, there's, you know, it's a lot of, when you go in the countryside, you don't see anyone under 70. I mean, everyone is so old.
Yeah, well, you know what?
Because the young people move to the cities.
That's happening all over the world. Well, Jeff, thanks for checking in from Thailand.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Glad you're doing well.
Thanks for listening.
I'll call back in a couple of weeks just to let you know what's going on. And just a quick side note, I'm on my way. I'm going to go to Cambodia in about a week or so. And, you know, I've been there many times before, and I just like to say, about the unions for people in the States that I just can't believe how people are going against their own best interests with being anti-union. When you see these people, right here, I mean, I can just walk outside my door and look at the maids in the hotel. I mean, they get paid very little. They work 6 or 7 days a week.
That's the way they're going to have us doing it.
15 hours a day.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeff.
Yeah.
Thanks for checking.
Thanks so much.
He can be, you know, like Mike Malloy on his show. He always has different correspondent. He can be Jeff can be our Asian correspondent.
Right.
Right. Here is Bruce. Bruce is in Royal Oak. Hi, Bruce. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You are on the air. Hey, Jeff, are you there?
I hear it. There.
Jeff. Or no, Bruce. Bruce.
Bruce. Okay, back on hold you guys.
Okay, yeah, no, he's thinking about it. All right.
he's thinking about it.
Here's Greg. Greg's in Auburn Hills. Hi, Greg, you're on the air.
Hey, hi, Peter. Hi, Jolene.
Hi.
I've been a long-time listener. I've listened to the onset of Rick since it started.
Cool.
And I was talking about, I'm sitting here listening to you guys, and, you know, it seems like it's not a democracy anymore. It's becoming an anarchy back, you know.
It's not anarchy.
No. And you know what? Pauline from Warren wrote in and said that it's totalitarianism. What have we been calling it, Peter?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Every time we turn around, they're telling us what we can't do, and we don't have a vote on it.
Well, the things that are, you know, like to say we can't smoke in bars or something like that, that's not the big thing. The big thing, and I'm sure you realize that, Greg, is what's going to happen to our economy, what's going to happen to how much we're getting paid, are we going to have any pension? You know, this Governor Snyder in Michigan, he's going to start taxing our pensions.
Well, I mean, every time the government needs money, they do a thing tax. You know, and I mean,
that, you know, that doesn't provide much. I mean, the government has the capacity to raise jillions of dollars. And we've already paid enough into it. Essentially, it is just, you know, how it is spent. All right, thank you very much. Here, get this. You talk about misleading headlines. This is from the Associated Press. Anger brews over government workers' benefits. And you go, whoa. And it's saying, when Erin McFarland looks at public workers, she sees lucrative pension benefits she doesn't ever expect to get. And that makes her mad. Well, so what would you think she would do? You would think she would say, I got to join a union. I've got to organize a union at my workplace. No.
What she wants those lucrative benefits.
No, she wants to drive them down. But not only that, anger brews over government workers' benefits. The Gallup poll taken, USA Gallup poll taken last month, found that Americans largely side with the employees, though about 2 in 5 that want government pay and benefits reined in. So that's 40%. 60%, actually it's over 60, but 63% of Americans do not want to come off the back of you know, people that have fought for it through their unions and that set the wage and benefit standards for American workers. But how about this? Enlisting prison labor to close budget gaps. And it talks about before he went to jail, Danny Ivey had barely seen a backyard garden, but they're talking about now how he's, you know, doing stuff that are the you know, doing work, essentially, in New Jersey, Georgia, California, places like that. But get this scenario. You have a union worker. He's getting a good union wage. And then because of cutbacks, he loses his job. Well, fortunately, there is still unemployment benefits, something the unions fought for. And without the unions, the conservatives, of course, were opposed to unemployment benefits. The conservatives were opposed to Social Security, were opposed to a minimum wage. So then he gets unemployment, and he's a, what do they call it, 99er. And then finally, his
which means you go for 100
weeks or something. Yeah,
99 weeks.
Yeah.
And then you're done.
Yeah.
They drop you.
Okay. So now he has no money, and this is my fictional worker, my fictional union worker, lost his job, runs out of unemployment, and then he stupidly commits a crime, right? He gets sentenced to jail, and in order to do something while he's in prison, he gets sent back as prison labor to do the job he gets fired from.
Oh, geez. Oh, man.
Why am I laughing?
That's sick.
Yeah. And it's what I said. Millions of public school students across the nation are seeing their class sizes swell because of the budget cuts and teacher layoffs, undermining a decades-long push by parents, administrators, and policymakers to shrink classes. And all these states have loosened their legal limits on size. It used to be that the average size of ninth grade English and math classes in Los Angeles is now 34, up from 20. 11th and 12th grade in these two subjects, they can have 43. Now, this is the kind of cutbacks to our schools that that these Republicans are aiming for. And this affects your average teabagger too. Your average teabagger isn't wealthy. They're a little upscale. You know, they're mostly the profile white, middle class and above, little above men.
They didn't grow up in poverty most likely.
Yeah, yeah. But we got to remember what everyone's saying, that America is not broke. Our pal Michael Moore said, let me say this. Oh, here. He said 400 Americans have more wealth than half of all Americans combined. Let me say that again. 400, as he says, obscenely rich people, most of whom benefited in some way from the multi-trillion dollar taxpayer bailout of 2008, now have more loot, stock, and property than the assets of 155 million Americans combined. If you can't bring yourself to call that a financial coup d'etat, then you are simply not being honest about what you know in your heart to be true. So, there is plenty of money in this country. It is just, where is it? Who has it? Richard Wolff, with two Fs, he's got a book out called Capitalism Hits the Fan. He says, he just wrote a piece called How the Rich Soak the Rest of Us. The richest Americans have dramatically lowered their income tax burden since 1945, both absolutely and relative to the tax burdens of the middle income. Say that for me. income groups,
you got it.
And the poor. So where our tax burdens have either remained the same or even risen, the ultra wealthy, the people that could have financed the country to the point where none of this would be happening, have reduced their tax burden and hence made more and more money. One of the places that the money goes all the time is the military. The real national security budget is $1.2 trillion a year. Just think about that. You could just lop off the $200 billion. I would still have $1 trillion mm-hmm. on these weapons systems that come out in New York Times today. They had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different weapons systems. Star Wars, which we've been fiddling around with since 1961, $135 billion already spent. A literal combat ship, future combat system, Ford-class supercarriers, F-35 Lightning II, global information grid, mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicle, Navy Marine Corps intranet. And all of that has cost us $1.3 trillion. Just that alone, we could probably cut the taxes on people out completely that make below $50,000. And, you know, in other words, the taxation schedule start at $50,000. We'd all have a $50,000 tax deduction. So if you made $58,000 a year, you'd pay $8,000. But like the average teacher in Wisconsin that makes $46,000 a year, whoa. Yeah. They're really ripping off the public. Let me get some calls on here. Thank you for being so patient. Let's try Bruce in Royal Oak again. Bruce, are you there with us? Bruce. I don't know.
Phantom. Phantom.
I wanted to get, he says, Canadians disrespecting us, eh?
Hey, we love Canadians.
But no, he says that. All right. I don't have a name here, but here is a caller. From Monroe, Michigan, the home of Fermi II and General George Custer. Hi, you're on the air. Who's this?
Hi, Peter. This is Wayne.
Hi, Wayne.
How are you tonight?
We're good.
Yeah, I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller. I agree with you on just about everything. I just wanted to supply a little education on nuclear power.
Sure.
I grew up in a family that was, well, my father's always worked in nuclear power plants. I can't really say they're a good thing, but I mean, I don't find them any worse than the other forms of power we have in this country at the time.
You mean like coal that does so much damage to the environment, the mining does
exactly.
So much damage, the gas, natural gas, which is destroying, all this land all over with this fracking and all that.
There's the storage problem.
It's like a slow death or a quick death.
Well, this is what I call capitalist blackmail, because what they say, do you want perhaps a slow death or do you want perhaps a fast death? Do you want unemployment or do you want a good environment? How come we don't have good choices?
It's about the system we've lived in, because we live in a country where most people are asleep and stupid.
Yeah.
And don't understand. Agreed. That they're being distracted by things like sin taxes, like the other caller talked about, and things like that to keep us from worrying about the things that really matter.
By lies. Flat-out lies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, nuclear power is not the answer to anything, but it produces more power than coal and gas. It is cleaner. I worked in a nuke plant myself. And you wear what's called dosimetry to measure the radiation, your exposure to it.
That sounds scary. That sounds scary still.
No, but it's very low, right?
Yeah, it's very low in the plants. And I went to, I live in Monroe, so I was working at Fermi 2, and I was actually working in Fermi 1, too, which they're still decommissioning after 15, 20 years now.
15 or 20? What are you talking about? It almost melted down in 1966.
No, they've been decommissioning the plant. They started in the mid-90s.
Oh, okay.
The plant was just shut down, mothballed.
Yeah.
Before that. They're actually taking it apart right now.
Wow.
So,
well,
I went to the coal burner plant, Detroit Edison, here in Monroe.
Horrible.
And my dosimetry picked up more radiation there than it did in my entire stay.
Well, we're right now limiting our energy choices to fossil fuels. Nuclear, gas, coal, all of them have dramatically bad side effects. I mean, if you talk about how many people have been killed because of oil, everything from accidents to wars, you wouldn't even be talking about nuclear power, to be sure. But nuclear power, again, we have this storage problem that is kind of daunting.
It's kind of big.
Yeah, they don't know where in the world to put it. But the fact that we are, I mean, first and foremost, we should be looking at conservation. That could cut out so much energy need. You have these big buildings. You look at night in New York City or Chicago or something like that.
My gosh.
Lit up like a Christmas tree.
Vegas.
Buildings with huge searchlights on it and on and on and on. So we ought to begin with that. And I know it sounds so green to talk about alternative energy, but we ought to give it a look.
Worby.
But, hey, I gotta take a break. So thank you. Appreciate your call. Some open lines have just come up. 313-298. We pay somebody to.
Let him do it.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Stotzenberger Institute. It's about hands-on training, national accreditation, unbelievable internal support. It's about your options.
Massage therapy, personal fitness trainer.
It's about state-of-the-art equipment, student-staffed massage clinic, lifetime placement assistance, student-teacher ratio. It's about the job.
You can be prepared for certification as a massage therapist or personal fitness trainer in just over 1 year. Stotzenberger Institute. Classes begin April 9th. SIToday.com.
We met through an online dating service. A perfect match.
We had everything in common.
Even our car insurance.
But we both have e-surance because we both love discounts.
We had a little scare, though, because I got all my e-surance discounts over the phone.
And I got all mine on their website.
But we realized it didn't matter how we got our discounts.
As long as we both had them.
To get your perfect car insurance discounts, get a quote today at esurance.com or 1-800-ESURANCE. E-surance, technology when you want it, people when you don't.
Not available in all states. Some restrictions apply. Discounts may vary by state. See site for details.
I love your eyes.
All around us. No wonder it's hard to imagine we're facing a water crisis. But we are. So that's why the American Planning Association brings you simple ways to save water at home and in your community. Learn more at planning.org. That's planning.org. A public service message from this station and the American Planning Association.
If you think of yourself as a technical person and want to pursue a career in technology, get started by calling ITT Technical Institute. At ITT Tech, you can develop knowledge and skills to pursue opportunities in a variety of career fields. Fields like electronics technology, information technology, and drafting and design. Call 800-741-5123. Thousands of graduates have launched new careers after attending the ITT Techs nationwide. Classes and day or evening courses meet at convenient times and teach skills used in the workplace. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career services are available for graduates. Make a technology degree program part of who you are. Call ITT Technical Institute for more information. Call right now. 800-741-5123. 800-741-5123. That's ITT Tech. 800-741-5123.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Jalene.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome to our second hour. And Jalene?
Yes, I wanted to say that someone posted on my Facebook, fans of Night Call are Werblies, Werby and Wobblies.
A lot of people don't know what Wobblies are. Wobblies are the old industrial workers of the world, and they're still around. You go to IWW.org, and they called, this was this radical trade union about 100 years ago or so, and they're still great. I mean, they used to organize lumberjacks and miners and people like that, and so they don't do it. They actually organize baristas now.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I'm doing a big report on baristas.
But we have
a page, and I call it Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, and make sure that you come and be our friend. We're growing, and we welcome you.
And also, again, Jalene and I are going to be part of this massive demonstration in Lansing. on Wednesday at noon in front of the Capitol building to protest this emergency, actually I can't remember the exact name of it, this Governor Snyder bill that would essentially turn the state into a dictatorship run by Governor Snyder. Destroy the unions, could even overturn the government of our cities, could actually abolish cities. And I would urge you, I mean, this always sounds self-serving. I guess everybody does that in entertainment, right?
Yeah, sure.
If I can do it. But my website, Peter Werbe, Werbe.com, because there is where, I don't know if you heard earlier, but we played this Rachel Maddow segment where she talked about the Michigan legislation that would turn all power in the state over to Governor Rick Snyder. And it says Michigan Republican plan worse than Wisconsin's, if you can imagine that. And there's the information about the demonstration in Lansing. There's a nice new photograph of me and Jolene. What else is there? Stuff about nuclear power? Indeed. Okay. So let's go back to our phone, 313-298-WRIF. And here's Art. Art's in Ypsilanti. Hi, Art. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. Nice to talk to you. I've heard you for a long time.
Thank you, Art.
My cheap little phone's about to run out, but I just want to say there's a thing called a Tobin tax, T-O-B-I-N.
Right.
If they would just tax Wall Street at anywhere from 5, 6, 7, 8, 9%, it would wipe out the entire debt overnight.
Or even slower, you know, if they just, some people have floated a 0.5% tax on stock transactions over $250,000, for instance. Well, how about this? How about this for a nice one, Art? Tax the damn rich. Why in the world were the tax breaks that Bush gave the ultra wealthy, the guys that caused the financial meltdown, why in the world did they get a tax break? They should be paying for all of this. None of us should be paying for this at all.
According to information I heard, Wall Street does $4.5 quadrillion a year in transactions. That's with a Q.
Okay, well, we could do 0.5% then.
And, well, yeah, they say they're taxed way less than 2, and at least 7 or 8 would wipe out every bill imaginable. Then we can go after the offshore money in the Cayman Islands and Monaco and Switzerland. There's trillions, hundreds of trillions there.
Sure. So this is the richest nation in the world. We have the most amount of accumulated wealth. We have the richest corporation, the richest people, and all that. So there's no reason that there should be any financial problems here whatsoever. The corporations are sitting on billions and billions, hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars that they're not spending or hiring new people or anything. So there also ought to be a tax on wealth. So we don't have people with accumulated wealth like Bill Gates or George Soros or Warren Buffett or the Koch brothers or anything like that. Leave, you know, tax it all. So that leaves them like with $50 million. That's enough for... that's enough for anyone to be rewarded for their invention. Yeah, yeah. All right, Art. Thanks for listening for so long and for calling. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Tim. Tim, hi. You're on the air.
Hi.
Where are you calling from, Tim?
I'm out in New Boston, Michigan.
Okay, you're on the air.
Julian talked about 1984.
Yes.
It dug up some old memories back there, some trivia. I remember George Orwell.
Yeah.
After visiting here one time, went back home and wrote up a little column about how the Americans were asleep.
Huh.
And as long as they had their plush green lawns and their fat Sunday newspapers, they wouldn't wake up until they heard the bombs going off around them.
Yeah, and he's onto something there.
Well, now it's a financial bomb. It's a financial bomb now.
Right, and maybe even at the same time it was... he said you could always count on the Americans to do the right thing after they've exhausted every other outlet.
Oh, man.
Well, George Orwell, I mean, most people think of only of 1984 and...
Animal Farm, you know, he's done...
Those two, but his essays about language, there's a book called Homage to Catalonia, which is about when he went to fight with the Spanish in the Spanish Civil War against the fascists that overthrew the government there.
Yeah, I think he had some insight.
He did.
Yeah.
Waiting on hold, you were talking about taxes, and I thought when did taxes become a bad word? It used to be a responsibility that people felt patriotic to help take care of things. You know?
Well, now most people get the feeling that they're getting so little back from it. And it's like I said, that if you're making, like the average teacher in Wisconsin, it's odd just because they've been in the news, they make, the average teacher makes $46,000. Well, to give up, I don't know, $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000 of that and try to raise a family. I mean, when we have enough wealth in this country that a person making $46,000 a year shouldn't have to pay anything, because what would happen then? If they had another $3,000-$4,000 a year
in their pocket,
they would spend it. But what happens? It goes to the government because there's this huge wealth transfer from us, and then they give it to the military industrial complex. They spend it on the war and drugs, or they give it to some horrible dictatorship in the Middle East. And now we're Mubarak in Egypt. How horrible! Yeah, of course, you know, we've only given him billions and billions of dollars.
Since
30 years he was in,
yeah,
so 71.
Or something, yeah. And the thing about the patriotic tax paying is, for me, I don't like at all where my tax dollars are going, so it's a different thing now, I think. People are thinking about it a little more, about where that money goes.
Thank you, Tim. Appreciate it. Open lines at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743. And we do have open lines now. So if you've been trying to get in and you couldn't, now's your chance.
You ready to get philosophical?
Ooh, I love that.
When you go to the Night Call Facebook, there's a page. There's also a discussion little page.
Yes.
Which, yeah, there's not much discussion on it. There's actually only a couple people. The people just sort
kind
of post links.
Things. Yeah, well,
which
that's
is
what
okay.
people do. That's a Facebook thing.
I'd like to hear a little more discussion.
I think they want you in there.
Oh. Can you, well, who are you? Why don't you get in?
Well, I'm a busy girl.
Here's somebody I'll answer on the air. I know this is so 20th century. I mean, you know,
no, I think this is
radio.
I like that you're doing it.
Yeah. But David posted on our Facebook page, he was talking about, he said, our movement, which means this conservative movement, is inclusive of all individuals. Well, all right.
Oh, yeah,
well,
I saw this.
Yeah. I don't even want to go to that part of it. As we do not see people in terms of groups, we do not advocate the writing of law in terms of groups, only the free and sovereign individual. I will post that socialism or other form of collectivism is deeply flawed from the standpoint that the individual is what is real. The group only exists as an abstract thought. This is Ayn Rand crap-a-roo, let me tell you.
Yeah,
terrible philosophy,
confused.
Terrible prose from that woman, and these people pick it up.
Peter, I read that and I went, huh?
This was in the New York Times on March 10th. Anthropologists studying living hunter-gatherers have radically revised their view of how early human societies were structured, a shift that yields new insights into how humans evolved from apes. Early human groups would have been more cooperative and willing to learn from one another than the chimpanzees from which human ancestors split about 5 million years ago. The advantage of cooperation and social learning then propelled the incipient human groups along a different evolutionary path. This doesn't fit with conservative thinking. Remember, we used to call them the cons,
neocons?
Just cons.
Okay.
Because they had a lot of double. Modern humans have lived as hunter-gatherers for more than 90% of our existence as a species. And, you know, these people, without any modern technology, managed to hold it together pretty well. And, you know, if you made
quite
a lot
amazing.
Of...
I took a lot of anthropology classes and I'm always amazed by how they
well,
survived.
I think there's a social... I mean, let's really send these... There's a sociobiology of socialism by its very definition. People are social animals. They're not autonomous individuals. That people affect.
We're not robots.
Yeah. Well, or what did I say? What was his word? The sovereign individual. We're not sovereign individuals. I mean, we should be free from the dictates of government that would restrict our freedom of speech or our right to assemble. All those things are in the American Constitution because there was this fear of authoritarian conservative government because that's who clamps down on people, which would include Stalinism, by the way, before you jump into your phone and say, well, the communists are... I mean, that was Soviet Union and all those countries are profoundly conservative. They have all the conservative values, the elevation of the family in this almost mythological manner, deep respect for the officials of the state, either well, in the communist countries, they would, you know, that there's almost a religion and almost the iconography, the pictures of Stalin and Lenin and people
everywhere.
Like that. Yeah. So they're deeply conservative societies. All right, if you want to pick up on do that, but let's go to, let's see, Diane and Troy. Hi, Diane, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Good, hi, Diane.
No, I apologize if I cut out. I'm kind of out of my service area.
Uh-oh.
No, you're fine. Sounds fine.
Great. Well, just to give you a little bit of background, I take an MCAT prep class in Ann Arbor. What this means is that these are students who are studying to take the medical college admissions exams. Students studying to become students.
Okay.
Who are trying to become doctors. Just
gotcha.
In case people don't know. And this is in Ann Arbor. So this is student-like mecca, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
So I bring up this crap that, I don't know if we're allowed to say that.
Yeah,
it's okay. I just said it before.
That one's okay.
Oh, I said crap-a-roo.
That he's trying to pull through. And this is what I say. He's, governor gains the ability at his discretion to declare a town and state a financial emergency. You know, whatever, everything that Rachel Maddow says.
Wait.
Everything that who says?
Rachel Maddow.
Oh, Rachel Maddow.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Much what she said. And so I'm in this small class, and I don't want to be outright contemptuous of my fellow, you know, students.
I hear you.
Not one of them in the class looked at me. Not one of them said, not a flinch at all. They had no idea this was happening, and they didn't care.
About Rick Snyder, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is below the radar.
They're in their bubble.
Yeah, I mean, this is, one of the things is, Snyder, probably under the tutelage of what's called the Mackinac Center, this conservative so-called think tank, put all this forth, and he didn't do it confrontationally the way this Governor Walker did in Wisconsin. So the only people paying any attention to this are the unions who are realizing what's going on. But I think people are beginning to wake up.
And it's kind of ironic because part of the MCAT test requires that students be up to date on current events.
Really? Oh, well, my gosh. Well, they have a long way to go here.
Well, one of the successful things that conservatives have done, they've depoliticized the entire society, partly because people don't feel very powerful, that they don't have any...
They feel powerless.
Yeah, they don't have any institutions of power. Well, like, for instance, in Britain, just a few months ago, you may have seen when the government announced it was going to raise college tuition. Like, they raise it here all the time. People go, oh, no, I'm going to owe more
money.
Here
we go again.
In Britain, these enormous student organizations brought out tens of thousands of people in demonstrations. The unions, which are still really powerful there and have a great influence on public policy, they brought people out. So everybody in society was aware of the debate over political issues, even whether you agreed with the government or not. I mean, you were there. So, what happens though? And I said at the beginning of the show, I think we're at the leading edge of an historic period, much in the way the 1960s and 1930s were in the last. In the last century. We're not in the 1950s. We're not in the 1980s.
There are some characters out there who are somewhat 50-ish, you know, McCarthy-ish.
Oh, yeah. All right, Diane, thank you very much for bringing that up.
And thanks, Diane, and good luck. It's cool. Peter, someone threw this one out. I know you love this one, so I'm going to thrill you with it. This is what this person says. We can end all U.S. monetary issues with the abolition of that illegal Federal Reserve.
Oh, yes.
Just right. for your listening pleasure, Peter.
Somewhere on my website. Go check that. I won't even answer. Somewhere on my website. I don't even know. It is so down, low. I don't know. What is it? On the down low.
No, it's not that. That's different.
That's the difference. What's the down low?
I'll tell you later.
Oh, don't say that.
Yeah.
All right,
don't say that. It's down on the page.
Yeah, it's down
on your
the
website.
Page. What do I know about these things? I've heard it said on television. I can't even. This is amazing.
Keeping it on. Okay.
Yeah.
It has a couple of different meanings.
Wow. Is a 2012 strike for a moneyless world. Then you wouldn't have to worry. Then you wouldn't need the Federal Reserve. Oh, man.
What are we going to do, just barter services?
I don't know. I didn't read that. It It's on my website, but I must have read it at some time. It sounded like an interesting idea.
Real quick, I've got another email. And by the way, our email is calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Yahoo.com.
Yeah, dude.
Oh, yeah. And this is from Debbie. And Debbie said she's enjoying the show about the six kids killed in Afghanistan. Initially, America didn't claim, quote unquote, credit. We blamed the parents by first suggesting that their parents killed their own children. Wow. And there's something with Naomi Klein. She also explained how come the Republicans have to deny climate change. Perfect explanation. Well, we'll look at it. Maybe we can put it up on your website here.
And Chris writes in the call talk, yes, at yahoo.com. Hey, why stop with the governor? We're talking about Governor Snyder, this emergency management bill where he could take over cities, fire the elected officials, get rid of all the unions, get rid of all the employees, abolish the city even. He says, let's give the president the right to dissolve state governments as he sees fit. Let's see how that goes over.
Oh, my.
I do like that.
Yeah.
You mentioned the 1950s. A good example of that, I think you were referring to it, this Republican Representative Peter King.
That's what I was, exactly.
He had a hearing on Thursday on the radicalization of American Muslims. And it turns out, though, this guy was a fervent supporter of the terrorist group, the Irish Republican Army.
Yeah.
I mean, how do they do this? He, according to an Irish journalist who wrote A Secret History of the IRA, he said that Representative King was an obvious collaborator with the IRA, that he complained himself that the Secret Service had investigated him as a security risk. So,
yeah, he's just doing his best to hype up.
So, yeah, you know, why do these Republicans always create these problems? They are, you know, wherever there is conflict, wherever there is distress, wherever there's meanness and conflict.
And greed, fear.
There these guys are. I mean, listen, we know that there are people within the Muslim community that, or people that identify themselves as Muslims that have been arrested for planning terrorist acts. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But I actually have a bug here. This is, okay, spring's on the way.
Actual bug, okay. Not a bug up here.
Yeah, right. For one thing, the purpose of legislative hearings is to determine what laws have to be enacted to help our society. What are you going to have for that? I mean, what should be done is law enforcement should be investigating anybody of any religion or any whatever. I mean, at least this guy, David, that wrote in ought to see this as not identifying people by groups. Just a couple of things. Alaska militia members arrested for plot to kidnap.
Anybody who listens to us know that. But the conservatives don't want to hear the truth, essentially, you know, what he was saying.
Yeah, but if you had to put NPR on a political spectrum, wouldn't you put it left of center?
I would.
Everybody.
Well, yeah, but then again,
not very left of center, and certainly not in periods when the U.S. is cranking up for a war. That's what we used to call it, nationalistic Pentagon radio. But go ahead.
I mean, but between you and them, you're reporting on what is happening, and the conservatives can't stand being called on their BS.
No, that's for sure. Well, because they're so disillusioned, they don't even get it.
And I mean, you know, Arizona state government, that's a death panel to me.
There you go.
Oh, yeah.
Rick Snyder's taxation of pensions, that's a tax hike to me.
Well, it certainly is. I mean,
so there's so much contradictory in what they say, and nobody's really getting out there with a booming voice.
Well, don't say that, Fred, because you're going to start hearing about this. As I said, the AFL-CIO is calling for a big march on Lansing on Wednesday noon at the Capitol building. People like me and Jolene are going to be up there, thousands of other people. And if you want to see the information about it, you can go to Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Fred, thank you for joining us as always. I said, does this happen? I started going through all this mess of stories and papers, looking for a story. I can't remember what I was looking for. Must have been something important. Here's Ted. Ted's in Detroit. Hi, Ted. You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing?
We're good.
Yeah, I'm calling because I have some concern that with all this going in Wisconsin, Michigan, where the governors are just taking people's rights away, and nobody from the legal community have thought about a lawsuit.
Oh, I'll bet they have. I don't know, Ted, but don't you think that they must have? Because they have Detroit is in their sights, right?
Of course.
Yeah, you know, because they care about people in Detroit, right? No, wrong. Oh, that's wrong. That's wrong. What they care about is destroying all aspects that have to do with any power base or electoral base of the Democratic Party. That's why they're going to go after Detroit.
Yeah, but the thing is, what I'm looking at, the thing is that when these people can appoint somebody to overrule your political vote, the individual vote, the collective vote for unions and so forth, then it just seems to me to be something unconstitutional about it.
You got it. And, yeah, I don't know, for instance, there's some thought that this bill that was just passed in Wisconsin abolishing the right of public sector workers to organize, that this violates what was called the Wagner Act. It was one of the first acts that was passed by the Roosevelt administration in the early 1930s. So, even though they're riding high right now, one of the things, and this must be obvious, and in fact it is obvious to a lot of the Republicans, suddenly they, with all of their arrogance in this attempt to strike at the heart of the middle class and the working class, they have awoken a sleeping giant. And I'll tell
that's
you,
for sure.
If there was an election in this country tomorrow, Barack Obama would probably, with all the complaints and criticisms I have, and there are a lot of them, I would still vote for him, that if the election was held today, like, say, Barack Obama against, what's that, Huckabee, what's his first name?
Mike Huckabee. Huckabee,
whatever.
Take a Huckabee.
Sarah Palin, I wasn't, and, or what's the Romney character and all that.
Mitt.
He would probably win, like, 80% to 20, that the Republicans would be swept out of office everywhere, because suddenly, the Diane was talking about how depoliticized her fellow students seem. There is a great politicalization going on, and people are beginning to realize what's at stake, and they know. I mean, when you get a figure that over 60% of people support the right of unions for collective bargaining, and we haven't even started yet, their days are numbered. They way out. Overplayed their hand. It's like I said, you know, when the Tea Party, the teabaggers, would organize in Wisconsin, they'd have a demonstration. Whoa, they'd have 1,200 people out there. There's like 100,000 people in Madison saying no to these baggers. So,
they can't take that away from us. They can't take away the fact that they were there. Yeah, we are there.
And actually, I'm getting pretty hopeful. All right.
Yeah,
thank
good.
You, Ted. Appreciate it. All right, let's see. Here's Anthony, Macomb County. Hi, Anthony. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
We're good.
Yeah, the reason I called was because I got slapped in the face last week when I went to go pay my delinquent taxes.
Uh-oh.
And yeah, I'm pulling over right now. I apologize for the noise. I'm in my truck. I'm 34 years old. I've been in business since I was about 22. And, things were always pretty good. And when things started slowing down back in 2009, you know, I fell behind a little bit. And, I was delinquent on my taxes. And I realized when I went to the county to go straighten things out.
Wait a minute, was business taxes or personal taxes?
On my property of my business.
Okay. All right.
And, I went into the county building to go pay, and they're about $7,000 a year. And, the amount of the interest rate that they were charging over there was putting me so far behind I couldn't catch up. It was just impossible. And,
I thought Snyder was supposed to be so pro-business.
With his pals. It is just unbelievable. And I'm the smallest business in my complex. And I started doing the math in my head. You know, my neighbors are about $20,000 a year on each side. And I'm just one little speck of a grain of sand
compared to all the businesses that are paying just in one little area. I cannot figure out where all this money goes to.
Yeah,
it's unbelievable.
Well, one of the things is it didn't. I can't remember whether it's already happened that. I thought Snyder, one thing was bringing in, was reducing these business taxes. You know, there's got to be, it's got to be something that that takes into account the differences of businesses and the straits they're in and all that. Because right. One of the things, if you don't have any penalty for being delinquent on your taxes, people aren't going to pay them, right? So,
yeah, I know. I mean,
so that is a problem. Like on the other hand, that you know, we don't want to drive you out of business. We want you in business, right?
Yeah, exactly. I laid off 7 guys since 2009. I'm down to 2.
Oh my gosh!
And that's it. You know, I don't even know what else to do at this point.
What if you want? What kind of business is it?
I'd rather not say.
Okay.
It's a business that should be doing good in these times.
Yeah, it's not. It wasn't like 7 women.
No.
Okay.
No.
I think massage parlors.
Oh, Peter.
Okay. No, but
yeah, we must get creative these days, well, I guess.
My whole problem is the average person that works for someone has no idea how much these buildings that are sitting are paying.
Yeah.
Where all this money goes, nobody understands that. You know, it's that $700 a month. You know, from 2 years ago that I had to make up.
Wow. Yeah.
It's just incredible, and I'm just a tiny, tiny little place. You know, the places next to me are. They're kicking in $20,000 a year each, you know, all the way down the street.
Well, there has to be some accounting, obviously. And where we got this lottery and schools are hurting. I don't understand that one little bit. All right. Well, Anthony, I hope it works out for you. Thank you for calling. 313-298-WRIF. And let's see. Here is here's Carl in Armada. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I wanted to talk about what was going on in Wisconsin.
With, sure.
With the strike. I really have a problem when people call it a collective bargaining right. Because I'm not a big union supporter, and it's not their right to collective bargain. I mean, it's not in every form of work where people have the right to collective bargaining. It's not a right, it's a privilege.
Well, I don't know. You're mincing words. What's the difference? I mean, who is the privilege? Who grants the privilege? I mean, that sounds like, you know, kings grant privileges. Citizens have rights. I mean, do you think the fact that you have freedom of speech is a privilege? It's a right.
No, that is a right. But where is collective bargaining given as a right? It's nowhere.
Well, it is not in the Constitution, but it, like I said a little earlier, it could very well be the attempt to abrogate collective bargaining rights could be a violation of the National Wagner Act, which grants unions the right to collective bargaining. Because before, you know, what would happen if you tried to organize a union back from the 1840s through to 1933 or 4, whenever the Wagner Act was passed? You know, they would call out the goons, they would call out the cops, they would call out the National Guard, they would call out the soldiers if they had to. So, I don't know. You know, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I don't even understand the purpose of making
the distinction.
The point is, 60% of Americans will say the collective bargaining rights are something that should be taken away. But when you put it in front of them and ask about collective bargaining privileges, 60% of Americans say it's not a necessity.
Wait a minute. You got the figure. They say over 60% of Americans support the right.
They're against what Scott Walker's doing.
Yeah. So they, and I don't know. I mean, it would occur to me to use that word. I mean, to say that 63% of the people support the privilege of collective bargaining. I don't know. I'm going to stick with the right.
You're cherry picking that one fact, but I just told you there's another study out there that says when you put it in front of Americans as collective bargaining privileges, if you don't put it as a right and you say privileges, they don't support it because it's all in the terming.
Well, send it to me. I think you're really underestimating the understanding that American people have. That when you don't have unions, when you have a union, you know, before it was all started by Reagan, one of the worst presidents in United States history.
Ever. Yeah.
Yeah. First act he does, I mean, and these guys have no loyalty, except to the ultra wealthy. He breaks this union, the PATCO union of airline pilots that are that supported them. But the other unions, you make $100,000-$125,000 a year, and well, they should. When I have somebody, I'm going to New York in a while. I want to be flown by somebody who is
well compensated
and loves his job and what have you. You go start going outside of the unions. And you got people like the people that crashed that last flight out of Buffalo 3, 4, 5 years ago, whenever, maybe just 3 years ago. They're making $22,000 a year.
Wow.
And they had work rules that were, pardon me, so reduced from how long, the rest time.
Between flights. Yeah.
They did not have the right as a collective bargaining unit to say, we want X amount of time. Off. I mean, part of that is determined by the Federal Aviation Administration. All right, got to go do some capitalism. Here you go.
You are listening to Nightfall with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
People choose 5-Hour Energy over 7 million times a week for lots of reasons. It's a nutritional supplement that really works. Its key ingredients are available in everyday food like broccoli, bananas, and avocados. It contains about as much caffeine as a cup of the leading premium coffee, zero sugar, and 4 calories. What will be your reason for choosing 5-Hour Energy? Its effectiveness? Its beneficial ingredients? There's only one way to know. Try it today.
Individual results may vary. See 5hourenergy.com for more details.
Is it time for a new roof? If the roof on your house is old, weathered, or in need of help, you can save $500 if you call Sears Roofing right now. Call Sears for a free in-home consultation at 1-877-938-1414. Call right now and you can save $500. Sears licensed, fully insured contractors can get your roofing job done right. Just call 1-877-938-1414. Sears has a variety of shingles and styles that are built for long-lasting performance. And you'll save $500 if you call now. So call 1-877-938-1414. Hurry, offer ends soon. Not available in all areas. Installation provided by Sears authorized licensed contractors. License information available upon request. So call Sears Roofing and save $500. Call 1-877-938-1414. That's 1-877-938-1414. Sears.
Now's the time.
Now's the time to make a difference.
Now's the time to do what's right.
To help a family.
Now's the time to volunteer.
To make a commitment.
To make new friends.
To make dreams come true.
To help a child.
Now's the time to help Habitat for Humanity build hope and change lives with a family in your community or around the world.
Now's the time.
Now, more than ever, help build it.
Visit Habitat.org.
Who's watching your home when you're not there? Protect your home with a security system monitored by ADT, the leader in home security. Just call Protect Your Home, your authorized ADT dealer. Call now and get $850 of hardware and activation for free. Call 1-877-653-8844. That's 1-877-653-8844. $99 installation charge. 36-month monitoring agreement at $35.99 per month. Call for terms and conditions and Protect Your Home license number.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
All right, this is our final segment, so if you'd like to get in, 313-298-WRIF.
Oh, yes, 313-298-9743.
At 1 a.m. Eastern Time, I'll be airing
an interview.
I was thinking which one. I mean, I think I'm going to do Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald first. They've written, as always, they've written an important book about Afghanistan. They've been covering Afghanistan since 1979. They said they didn't think we were going to grow old covering this war.
Yeah.
Crossing Zero, and we'll tell you what that is, the AFPAC. War, Afghanistan-Pakistan War at the Turning Point of American Empire. And also Ronit Avni, who is the executive director of Just Vision, and she's the producer of a documentary that's going to start, is it started there already? At the main theater in Royal Oak. It's called Budrus, and that's a Palestinian village where they employ nonviolent methods to resist this Israeli barrier that's going through there. And they get together. They've got Israelis there, Palestinians. They've actually got Hamas and what's the other group all of a sudden? It's out of my brain.
Well, that's amazing.
It'll let it stay out of my brain.
Well, you'll hear it at
Fatah
in about an hour. Yeah, Fatah.
And Israelis coming in there to support these protesters in this village. And actually, the film's a little hard to see. I mean, these Israeli soldiers just start kicking the crap out of these women.
I don't think I can do it. Those things are too painful to watch. I mean, reading about it is enough. We got an email from Scott who said, whites, as in white people, control every institution in this country, government, business, mainline, churches, charitable agencies. Given that, it's very difficult to take claims of oppression of white people seriously, he said. Only when whites are seriously affected by the economic downturn, as they have been the past 5 to 6 years, is recession taken seriously. When recessions are confined to minority populations, whites largely don't care. And I'm white, he said.
And often the minority population, good segments of it, are in permanent recession.
That's right. And Peter and I, we resigned from the white race years ago. In the interest of humanity.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Patrick in Mount Clemens writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, referencing your caller on collective bargaining rights. Yeah, you know, boy, I love my callers. collectively, they're much smarter than you and I together. On collective bargaining rights, they were granted by and large to public workers who cannot strike by law. So they are a right. They're granted by law. That's right, because that's what Walker and now Governor Snyder here in Michigan wants to do, is to repeal the rights they have under law. Since they can't strike police and fire, their recourse is collective bargaining. You would say, I don't think anybody from the UAW or the communication workers or people like that would say, we have a right to collective bargaining. Yeah. Right. So forget it. You know what? This was I just occurred to me. Now that I realized on Comcast that Fox News is right above CNN, I tune in, and they were talking about, that was their same little talking point. It's not a right. It's a privilege. So come on, man. Think for yourself.
I want to say hi to Peter.
Hi.
You, but another Peter who wrote in and says, you guys rock. I've listened since the late 80s. Thanks for doing all you do. Well, we appreciate you listening.
Sure thing.
Keep on doing it.
Fishville and Belleville. Phil, hi. You're on the air.
I just want to call in and say thanks for all that. I miss your guys' voice. Get ready to get deployed for my fourth term in Afghanistan. As a matter of fact, I'm leaving next week. And
Your fourth you term?
Fourth?
I just want to say thanks for all that you do, you know. Appreciate, you know, especially all us troops. You guys do a good thing for all of us, so.
Well, stay safe. And come back soon.
Call us when you get back. How long are you going to be there?
I'm going to do a 15-month.
Oh, my gosh. Do you have a wife and kids?
This will be my fifth term, so it's I did two terms in Iraq, and this will be my fourth term in Afghanistan.
You've done seven terms in combat zones?
Yes, sir. Yes, I have.
Wow.
That's
insane.
Yeah, I do all I can for our country, you know what I'm saying? It's red, white, and blue, and I miss your guys' voices. I just want to appreciate
Phil.
What you guys do for all
right.
of us. So.
And stay safe. Come back soon, and let's end that damn war.
Yes.
10 years now, longest war in American history. That's one of the things we'll be talking about at 1 a.m.
Yet another thing we predicted back in 2001.
Yeah. Here's Paul in Plymouth. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
It's like calling. Usually I call in every week with some film news.
Yeah.
I wanted to comment on property taxes.
Sure.
I work in the real estate business, real estate development, commercial properties, and residential. And I think we're almost at a point in the state's history where we need to literally roll back the taxes and even start fresh.
Property taxes?
No, property taxes.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
Yeah. Paul, our cities are dying because the tax revenues are nosediving because the property values are going down. If you're talking about lowering property taxes, you might as well say goodbye to the Plymouth police force.
Well, we're already that's, we've already taken enough hits. I'm just saying, though, people are trying to come in here, especially in the commercial end. Some of these property taxes are so high. You want to come in as a small business owner and purchase a building or some land. It's almost impossible to do that and to start a small business.
Because of high property. Well, see, this is what happens. You think, if you want some economic development, and this is, and I'm not trying to put this on you, but I mean, this essentially is what Governor Snyder says and all that. We're restricting businesses' capacity to start and to expand because of different business taxes, including property taxes. So you think, well, gee, if we had businesses, then we'd have employees, and then there would be more income tax and all of that. But this gets back to this whole deal that that there's not a wider picture being looked at. I mean, why in the wealthiest country in the world do we have to even have this conversation? I mean, why, for instance, don't we have a situation where if your income from your business wasn't over $500,000 a year, you wouldn't have to pay any tax, for instance, because we were distributing this wealth that is flowed so much to the high side of things. And you say, well, all right, I mean, maybe that's true, but let's do something practical. I don't think we can do anything practical by lowering property. Well, let me put it this way. We're screwed because there's some truth to that. If you have high property taxes, this Anthony called in earlier, mm-hmm. and he was saying what a difficult time he was having paying property tax. And so if you lowered property taxes, what would you have? You'd have less income.
But, you know, for years and years and years, we drove up the value of properties, overinflating them. And that drove up the taxes. And, of course, our politicians have, you know, created a bigger government and kept spending that money. Now we're in a crunch. And for people to come in, though, to start new businesses, I mean, I'll give you an example, tax abatements. In our community, we used to have, a huge demand for light industrial and manufacturing here. Uh-huh. There still is to a certain extent. But we would give people 15-year tax abatements where they don't have to pay any taxes. And now it's, you know, 6, 7, 8 years later, these companies have bailed, and there's no recourse.
Sure.
They didn't have to pay taxes for all those years, and we were hoping it was, you know, after the 15th year, we're going to really get the taxes back. And they just left. You know, they can't do business here anymore.
Or there is a more blackmail. They say, okay, who's going to give us the biggest tax abatement? Is it going to be Michigan, or is it going to be Texas or Ohio? Come on, just do a little bidding. Okay, 6 years. Okay, 8 years. Okay, 9 years. So you have companies, these companies that have that kind of flexibility in where they're going to locate, essentially whipsawing tax-starved states.
Hey, can I mention one more thing?
Sure.
I know with all this film stuff going on, you guys have had a great deal of interest in this, and you do your interviews at 1 o'clock. Have you ever thought about maybe interviewing some of the film people here? Or like a Jeff Daniels, for instance, or someone who can...
That'd be awesome.
We should do that.
I love Jeff Daniels.
You know, someone who can see the inside of the business and, you know, kind of share with you and your listeners what's going on.
Is he your pal?
No, he's not a pal. We've worked for him before. Nice guy. There he is.
We can probably reach him. That's a good idea.
Hey, one more thing. That guy was in Iraq.
Yeah.
You guys need to, like, get his name and address or whatever, get him to call back and send a case of baby stickers over to Afghanistan.
Like a baby.
Yeah.
Like
a baby.
Except he doesn't work here anymore.
It'd be kind of cool.
You can send him riff stickers.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Paul. Yeah, but maybe he's listening. Hi, Art, if you're listening. Yeah. All right, some open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Don in Southgate. Don, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. This is I'm a first-time caller.
Well,
and I work for a local automotive supplier, and I'm a UAW representative. I've been that way for 12 years.
Great.
And bottom line is the caller a few minutes ago that mentioned that there was no right for collective bargaining, he's totally wrong. There is a right for collective bargaining. And if you think about it, 30 years ago, the biggest employer in America was General Motors. Now it's Walmart.
Yeah.
So if you really think about it, the way this country is going, I mean, the middle class is being crushed. And people aren't, they're just not awake. It's like, people are at the wheel and they're just asleep. And
yeah.
I wish, like I said, it's come to the point now you get these people like this governor in Wisconsin that they just want to crush the unions. And it's like now maybe it has woken a sleeping giant. I'm hoping that's what happens, because it just upsets me as a union member, like on the Fox News and things like that, that they act like union is such a bad word and they brainwash people. And if you think about it, when the union in its heyday in 1950 was its strongest, that's mm-hmm. when people made a good living. And now, look at it now. It's like they just it's weakened to the point that like I said, that we're almost a third world country, in my opinion.
Well, we're heading there. Don, Peter always says Guatemala.
Yeah, Don, you want to know a dirty little secret about all those talking heads on Fox?
Sure.
They're almost all union members. They're all members of my union, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, AFTRA. AFL-CIO.
And that's a shame.
I want to get them kicked out.
Very hypocrites.
I mean,
call
you know,
a meeting.
I give everybody an opinion. That's their opinion. And,
yeah, I would never want to
God
kick them
bless them. But you know what? They're totally wrong, and they just really want to brainwash people in this country to thinking that unions are just so bad. I have some as a UAW member. I have some problems sometimes with my union.
Of course, we all do. What kind of bureaucracy or institution do you not have a problem with?
You do not. You always have a problem with them. But guess what? It's unions were in place because corporations and businesses in the past, bottom line, harassed people, killed people, things like this. And I just feel like we're going backwards. You know what I mean?
Well, we are. Is there any talk about this demonstration in Lansing on Wednesday at noon that Jillian and I are going to call by the AFL?
Really, I didn't even know about it until I found out about it on your program.
Well, I'm going to call Bob King, the president of the UAW, and say, Bob, get the news out.
Well, it's like I work for a small, we're a tier two supplier, right? So
okay.
We're a small company, and like I said, we're not the big three. You know what I mean? So
sure.
Kind of sometimes we get skipped by, but like I said, I will spread the word. Actually, I was thinking about making a trip up there on Wednesday.
Well, go to my website. My last name is spelled Werbe, so it's peterwerbe.com. Hey, you know, here's my take on small shops and of the deindustrialization. In 1952, when one of the first shops like yours, union shops, decided to move to Alabama so they would avoid being unionized,
sure.
Walter Reuther should have called a general strike in auto or warn him, say, if you leave this state, if you start to destroy what we have literally shed blood and tears for, we're stopping this whole industry. And, of course, you know, they probably thought, well, you know, that's not... I don't know what, but that didn't even occur to them. But if they would have put a stop to that right now, we would have not been looking at the industrial situation that we are. All right. Thanks, Don, and I'll look for you in Lansing.
Yeah.
And that's what you do. Go to our website where you have this great new photo of me and Jolene. I'm mostly taken with Jolene. So,
oh, Peter.
So you'll recognize this and come up and
keep
say
flattering
hello.
Me.
All right, here's something that's right on target. It's Maurice from Detroit. Hey, Maurice, you're on the air. How you doing?
Hey, Peter, Jolene, how y'all doing?
Good.
Maurice, good.
Are you on Skype?
Yeah, I was looking at something up the other day by JFK, Cave Assassination.
Yeah.
And you know what? I don't know if it was meaning, but you can never guess who was in Dallas the day that he got killed.
I think
George
I know.
George W. Bush.
No, his dad. His dad was there.
I mean, his dad.
H.W., yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I don't know what part of Texas that the Bushes from.
What part were they from?
I don't know. I don't know.
You
how
know
they,
what?
I don't even know how they got to Texas. Weren't they? They were from the East. He's like, you know,
he's
rich
a Harvard boy.
Eastern,
you know, right?
Yale, Skull and Bones and all that.
Oh, yeah.
But Peter.
Yeah.
Isn't it kind of strange that he was the head of the CIA at that time? He was in the same city, and the person that got assassinated.
Well, I don't know. You know, it was like Pretty Boy Floyd, every crime in Oklahoma. He's reaching. No, but
you know, Maurice is getting a little conspiracy on
us. Yeah. What's
But he's thinking. I like that he's just
Thank you, Maurice. Thank keep you. Checking it out. But what's the book by Tom Hartman and Waldron? We always forget. Yeah. All right. Someone will tell us. Let's see. Here is Dakota. Dakota, where are you calling from?
Hey, how you doing? I'm calling from Detroit.
Go ahead. Hi, you're Dakota. On the air.
Yep.
And, yeah. Can you kill your radio?
I comment on the guy that just called.
Hey, Dakota.
The union.
Dakota, hold on here. Hold on.
Okay.
Yeah, can you shut your radio completely off?
Did you say you just called? He just called. Yep. No. He said he just called.
He's talking about the guy that just called.
Oh, okay. All right.
Okay, go ahead.
All right.
We're all good now. Gosh, yeah, good. I feel better.
All right.
What's up, Dakota?
Oh, not much. Just hanging out in the garage. Listen, I'm just calling about the guy that just called about the union.
Yeah.
You know, everybody putting a bad name out there.
Yeah.
He's right. You know, the union is, you know, they're all a bunch. It's a lot of people out there in the union. Okay.
Oh, there went your beer can, your beer bottle.
And, you know, it's always a bad name about the union, this and this and that.
You know what, though? I don't think you just hear that on television. Sometimes your neighbors. But, if you got a union job, you got a better job than a non-union job.
Right. Right, exactly. And a lot of people, they don't like that. Oh, you're in the union. Oh, you make this much money. Hey, you know what? They do their job. They do it good.
But you know what else? If you let, these conservatives talk about the free market. Well, the free market in labor means the more people you got looking for jobs, the less money you're going to get. And what unions do, they can demand a standard for wages and for benefits and for retirement and all that. And everything, every benefit, every wage, everything that has to do with work, if you're in a union industry, you do better. And rather than people, and getting these people that resent you because you're making a decent wage is so crazy.
Yeah.
That what they should be doing. Well, let me just, do I got time? Yeah. There were, in the late 1930s, when there started to be these sit-down strikes where auto workers occupied auto plants, these shop girls, as they called them then, at Woolworth's in downtown Detroit, they held their own sit-down strike. And they said, we want to have a union. And they didn't say, oh, I hate those auto workers. They're making so much money. They said, hey, if they can do that, we can do that. And that's the way it should go. I got to take one more quick call, Dakota. So thank you for your opinion and have fun in the garage.
You know what's so funny is I know several people listen every Sunday night in their garage.
In the garage.
They got their little ashtray, their little chair.
It's a guy thing.
Yeah. Someone we work with, his brother. Hey Chris.
Hey, Joe. Hello. Joe, tell me quick. We're almost out of time.
How you doing?
We're good.
Joe.
Yes, I was calling because I have a friend that took a class, and what I was saying is that a lot of what you run into is that when you get into the schools, the professors are teaching a lot of the people that the unions are the reason that there's, what's going on. Gee, the unions drag down the amount of people or the quality of the work. They make it, you get a high wage for doing nothing and...
What do you think? Professors teach that? You professors are usually kind of liberal.
That's pretty bad.
Absolutely. That was. He had a business professor.
Oh, a business professor.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no wonder.
He said that if you turn around, his philosophy was that if you took your money and you gave it to the corporation, what they would do is they would turn around and invest it in more business and... then, that can expand everything.
Yeah, except that's nonsense. And I think, what are they doing with, what are the corporations doing with their money?
They basically take that money, they put it in the bank, and then they turn around and show that they've made this profit.
Right.
And they made the profit, now they get, a dividend from their
His friend should get his money back.
Yeah, well.
What a ripoff. He was lied to.
Well, actually, you hit it right on the head, Joe. So these corporations, which have had profits for the financial sector, are up 750%. And what they're doing, exactly what you're saying, they're just cashing in on it all. They're holding on to their money. They're not expanding their businesses. They're not hiring new workers. It's Fat City for them.
Yeah, chilling by the pool.
Yeah, chilling by the
pool.
All right, got to end the show. So thank you, Joe, for being our last caller. Jillian Jordan, it's I usually only see you on Sunday, so we're going to get together on Wednesday.
We are.
We're going to travel to Lansing, Michigan.
Yes.
We're going to meet in front of the Capitol building at noon. And it won't just be me and her. There'll be thousands of us, organized by the AFL, the state AFL, Mark Gaffney, president.
Come and join us.
Come and join us. Go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Get a gander of our photo, and then you can come up to us and say, hey, Peter, hey, Jalene.
Yes.
Power to the people. No, yeah. Don't try to sing.
Oh, yeah.
You want to try it?
No. It's too late.
All right. Got a couple of great interviews coming, one about the Afghan war and also then about how actually can nonviolence work in the Middle East, all that ahead. We got to thank everybody.
Thanks Aaron. To our crew.
Yeah, we got the
Aaron, Athena, Sarah. We got the power team in there.
We do. What was I got? Team Night Call.
Team, I love it.
All right. We'll take your calls next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Who's watching your home when you're not there? It could be a burglar. Burglars prefer to break in when they think no one is home and no one will stop them. Don't be an easy target for intruders. Protect your home with a free security system monitored by ADT, the leader in home security. Pick up your phone now and get free hardware, free medical and fire alerts, and free activation. It's an $850 value. Just call Protect Your Home, your authorized ADT dealer, at 1-877-653-8844. You'll get 24-hour protection, and there's no cost for parts or activation. Call now about a free security system monitored by ADT. Call 1-877-653-8844. $99 installation charge, 36-month monitoring agreement at $35.99 per month. Call for terms and conditions to this offer and protect your home license numbers. Call now, 1-877-653-8844. That's 1-877-653-8844.
How do you prepare for jobs involving electronics technology, drafting and design, or information technology? Call ITT Technical Institute. Develop knowledge and skills that you could use to pursue many opportunities in promising career fields. At ITT Tech, classes meet just a few days a week, and financial aid is available for those who qualify. Call ITT Tech now for more information. 800-741-5123. That's 800-741-5123.
Jeez, Q, it's hot as in here. What's going on?
Oh, it's only 91 degrees.
Where? In the refrigerator?
Ouch!
The countertop is so hot you can fry eggs on it. And bacon and home fries. Are you on that sweat diet?
No.
I'm melting my life away.
Hey, by not running my air conditioner, I'm saving energy and helping the environment.
Uh-huh. There's an easier way to help the environment. Go green. Go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment, and you don't have to sweat it, if you know what I mean. So you got any eggs?
No.
How about shrimp? We can fry shrimp. Do you have any shrimp?
No. I have anchovies.
No.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
I guess we got caught up in the crazy housing boom.
We had been in the house so long, we didn't want to lose it.
What these people share is that they all got in trouble with their mortgages, and they all called a certified housing counselor for help.
Our housing counselor looked at our paperwork and she knew something was wrong.
She understood what needed to be done, and she helped me work it out with the bank. This is a free service. Call the National Foundation for Credit Counseling now. Call 1-866-687-6322 or visit mortgagehelpnow.org.
WRIF and Live Nation present the RIF's 40th Anniversary Concert. Stone Temple Pilots live. April 20th at the Fillmore Detroit. Celebrate 40 years of WRIF rocking Detroit with Stone Temple Pilots. Tickets for STP are going fast. Get yours now at all Ticketmaster outlets or online at LiveNation.com. WRIF's 40th Anniversary Concert with Stone Temple Pilots. April 20th, the Fillmore Detroit. From Live Nation and 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
If you think of yourself as a technical person and want to pursue a career in technology, get started by calling ITT Technical Institute. At ITT Tech, you can develop knowledge and skills to pursue opportunities in a variety of career fields. Fields like electronics technology, technology, information technology, and drafting and design. Call 800-741-5123. Thousands of graduates have launched new careers after attending the ITT Techs nationwide. Classes and day or evening courses meet at convenient times and teach skills used in the workplace. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career services are available for graduates. Make a technology degree program part of who you are. Call ITT Technical Institute for more information. Call right now. 800-741-5123. 800-741-5123. That's ITT Tech. 800-741-5123.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here for with you. And the war in Afghanistan has been going on longer than any war in United States history. Is it coming to an end? Defense Secretary Robert M. Gates said last Tuesday the United States faces an acid test this spring and summer to determine if the gains in the war are sustainable. He says that it's unlikely that there will be any troop withdrawals in July from the hard-fought southern part of the country, but he notes that President Obama has ordered that withdrawals begin in July, and American commanders are determining that they will where they will come from and how many there will be. Well, is that going to happen? How do we find out what in the world is really going on there? Can we trust the word of politicians and generals that have such a vested interest? Well, if you're a longtime listener to this show, you know that when I want to find out about Afghanistan, then I go to Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald. They've written a number of books on Afghanistan, and they began working together as a husband and wife team as long ago as 1979. They were the first U.S. television crew granted visas to enter Afghanistan in the spring of 1981. They produced documentaries on that. A number of books they've helped with and written with other people. The last time we interviewed them was with their 2009 book, Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, and you can find out about their new book and also Invisible History at invisiblehistory.com. The new book is Crossing Zero. Now get the title, because we're going to have to ask about every part of this. Crossing Zero, the AFPAC War at the Turning Point of American Empire. There is so much there, but it's a pleasure to welcome back Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald. They're in their office in Boston. Welcome back to the program, guys.
Thanks so much for having us on again.
Thank you, Peter. It's great to be here.
Okay, the war goes on. I mean, this, remember, like in 1984, we've always been at war with Afghanistan, it seems. I mean, some of my listeners are, you know, probably were 8 or 9 when this began. So it is like Winston Smith. The war was, you know, in 1984. The war was always going on. And yet it's really on the back burner. How do you feel about writing a book on a war that's on the back burner?
We've been writing this book now for 30 years. I was 29 years old when initiated this this particular mission in my life, and I did not intend it to be my life, but it just keeps rolling back in. We actually walked away from it at one point in 1987, 1988, and then got dragged back into it again by Oliver Stone, who was very fascinated by what we had done initially. So, this thing called Afghanistan, it's, you know, we've looked at it now for 30 years, for over 30 years, and it's kind of like the proverbial train wreck in slow motion. And that's what we see. We see that there were a lot of things that were going on in the early 1970s, mid-1970s, where the interest, military interests moved from Southeast Asia into South Central Asia, from Vietnam into Afghanistan and that part of the world. And a lot of it has to do with international finance. A lot of it has to do with the posturing of the West versus the East. The only difference being, of course, is that when we left Vietnam in 1975, aside from the, you know, the humiliation that the United States suffered, there really was no strategic disadvantage to losing Vietnam. In fact, that's what people kept saying. You know, what are we there for in the first place?
Well, here we are in a situation in Afghanistan with Pakistan and Iran next door, China, India, Russia's involved in this business. We're, the United States is working on and off with all of these different agencies in one capacity or another. And so it's a very complicated thing that the United States just simply cannot pick up and walk away from the way it did in Vietnam. There are consequences here. And, of course, one of the big consequences is the fact that the United States really did contribute to the problem in the 1980s by supporting, as we know, Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen freedom fighters who are actually have since turned into drug-running warlords that have been put into the Karzai government. And so a lot of the problem that we're facing right now, this broad-brush Taliban issue is an example, a lot of those groups aren't really Taliban. A lot of the people that the United States are fighting are basically local village militias that are angry with the corruption and the overt corruption of the Karzai regime, and so as a result of that, the Americans are getting caught in between in the firefight. So it's a ridiculously complicated mess at this point.
Well, Elizabeth Gould, picking up on what Paul Fitzgerald just said, your husband and co-author of Crossing Zero, we, the United States, have been at war in Asia really since the beginning of 1942. That's almost 70 years. Why are we? We know why we were at war beginning with military action in 1942, after we were bombed in 1941 by the Japanese. But we have a long history of insertion into that region pretty far from home.
I really do think that you have to go back to 1947 when the British Empire basically left the region and really left it in the hands of the United States. So that really put us right in the driver's seat. And, of course, with the creation of the state of Pakistan, basically three-fifths of which was Afghanistan at one time, going back to the creation of the Durand Line in 1893, which is still a very contentious and very unresolved issue and a key to understanding why it is so difficult to really resolve anything in the region, because there are, we're talking about very complex social structures that live in the region that now is Pakistan, that really do not consider themselves to really be really a part of Pakistan. This is where you have the regions where the supposed Taliban go back and regroup. So you're looking at, I think, a legacy that really has to be understood going back to the British Empire's legacy in the region. And then as you begin to also look at the Cold War, post-World War II, you're looking at the creation of the national security state and the whole Cold War era beginning. So needless to say, you're going right into the empire, the region of the Soviet Empire up against the American Empire. And that was really inaugurated, once again, very close to post-World War II. So this is really part of the legacy. And when it came to Afghanistan, a lot of people need to realize they view this war as the longest war that the United States has ever been involved in. But the truth is the United States was heavily involved in the background of what was going on in Afghanistan going back to really 1973. So once again, the perception of when things begin and what's really going on, is so misunderstood by so many circles of people. And this includes, unfortunately, journalists, politicians and policymakers who are engaged actively in trying to come up with solutions or, as journalists, trying to come up with useful coverage of the complexities of these situations. And they really aren't aware of, even when the real beginnings of these things really began to stir and really began to make a difference.
My guests on the Peter Werby Show, Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, they've just published Crossing Zero, The AFPAC War at the Turning Point of the American Empire. It's published by City Lights Books. It's a wonderful publishing house. And their website is invisiblehistory.com. There'll be a link on my site as well, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, .com. I said at the beginning of the interview that we're doing that I would explain, rather I would have you explain, the title, Crossing Zero. That probably on the face of it doesn't mean much to folks. What's the title refer to?
Well, you know, zero line is the line that separates Pakistan and Afghanistan. Officially, it's known as the Durand Line. It was established by the British Foreign Secretary for India in 1893. He drew a line down the middle of the Hindu Kush and said, everything on this side is mine and everything on that side is Afghanistan, on the western side is Afghanistan of India. And when the United States became involved there during the Cold War with its ally Pakistan, that line became known by the intelligence and military community as zero line. It was the point, it was like the no-go line. You didn't go beyond that. Afghanistan was considered to be denied territory. The United States couldn't occupy it, couldn't put troops there. The Afghans, one of the things that they did, that the Afghans did that kind of annoyed Washington was they wouldn't join in one of these treaty organizations. I'm sure you remember that there were all kinds of these treaties, CETO and Southeast Asian Treaty Organization and a number of different trade pacts that were done in the 50s and 1960s. And Afghanistan wanted to remain in this kind of 19th century position of being a neutral buffer state between the Soviet Union and the United States. They really didn't see any advantage in signing on with one side or the other, except for the fact that they'd wind up occupied by an army. And so as a result of that, the zero line now. So in terms of the zero line is what we've called the book because it's kind of the mother of all metaphors. The United States really, as you mentioned earlier, Peter, has been at war in Asia at least since, well, actually, if you consider what happened with Japan, the gunboat diplomacy, who was the admiral that sailed his gunboat into Tokyo Harbor in the 18th? Was it Commodore Perry?
Perry it was, Commodore Perry, yeah.
Yeah, sailed his gunboat. I remember this from high school or grammar school. He pointed his cannon up at the Imperial Palace and said, either you open your doors to us or I fire. And so that was the beginning of America's involvement in that part of the world, and that was a long time ago. Well, that was the same time period that the British were involved there, too. In Afghanistan with their trading organizations, with their trade in which they basically became, their companies became a government, a form of government. So you had this hybrid with the British, with their East India Trading Company, where a corporation actually became the government. So you had this long history of what's going on there. And of course, that was the extent. When they got to Afghanistan, they got to the Hindu Kush. That was the extent. That was the zero line for the British Empire. They couldn't go any further. Their empire ended there. They rolled it up in 1947, turned that part of the empire over to the Muslim community of India and named it Pakistan. And so what we've been dealing with ever since is this kind of almost a mystical line that separates what can be done from what can't be done. The Russians went there. Their empire ended there. Britain's empire ended there. The United States has now fought on both sides of the line. They fought on the Pakistani side of the line on behalf of the Mujahideen back in the 1980s, and they're now fighting on the other side of the line on behalf of the Afghan government. And so the United States has, in that sense, crossed zero. And after 10 years of doing this, the longest war in American history, I think that's it's a metaphor in and of itself.
The book is Crossing Zero, and Paul Fitzgerald just explained the meaning of it. Elizabeth Gould, Paul's co-author, maybe we should get to the subtitle. First, the AFPAC War, and we just usually call it the Afghan War, the war in Afghanistan. But also at the turning point of American empire, the Russians had an empire, the British had an empire, Americans don't have an empire. That's sort of a pejorative, a negative word. We're just, even with Commander Perry, he just wanted trade, and also we're around the world because we're trying to extend democracy. They have an empire. We're a peaceful nation, even though we've been fighting there for 100 years or so. I'm sorry, that was a lot there. The meaning, the AFPAC war and the whole idea of an American empire and it being at a turning point.
Well, you do have to go back once again to the creation of the state of Pakistan when the United States first entered into the region actively and really partnered with Pakistan in terms of being its front in the region. And it was very much, you know, a part of the whole Cold War scenario for the region. And Afghanistan was really quite ignored by the United States. In fact, there were a lot of problems over the decades because of the fact that the United States constantly sought Pakistan's support, and any kinds of regional things going on that really ended up impacting negatively on Afghanistan. And these are things that had to do with the fact that when Pakistan was created, Afghanistan's access to the ocean was completely cut off. So you have a landlocked situation, and that meant that they have to go through Pakistan anytime they wanted to trade with the outside world. This ended up becoming a very serious problem over the decades. And you also had, inside Pakistan, you had different kinds of political, unfinished political business. This really was a legacy of the British Empire and the elite ruling class that took over, the Punjabis, who really had always been, kind of at odds with the Afghans. So a lot of the region that became Pakistan now was actually being, kind of run effectively by an ancient conflict that goes deep into the roots of the differences between the tribal people in the region. So these are all the complexities that the United States really got into. But the one constant all those years, up to and including the 1980s, when the United States decided to draw the Soviets into Afghanistan, use Afghanistan as the place to lure them in and then destroy them, and basically had the whole financing set up through Pakistan, who then got to effectively not only choose who was going to get the financing, but choose those people that actually ended up serving Pakistan's political interests rather than the interests of Afghanistan. So these are all the complexities. Now, then you come up to, after 2001 and the eventual involvement of the United States directly in Afghanistan, and after, I think it was about 7 or 8 years, I guess, when Obama first came in, the idea that they had to begin to shift a little bit away from this constant reliance on Pakistan. They had to eventually really begin to recognize that Afghanistan had a separate position in this. So that effectively became the term that got coined for it, became the AFPAC policy. And then, as now we're in the phase where there is an acknowledgement that there's an imbalance there that has affected things.
I might add this, Peter, is that, the irony of America's, whether the United States technically has an empire or not, defined by the Roman Empire, the British Empire, or whatever, the fact is that at the end of World War II, a lot of these countries, Afghanistan and India and countries in the Middle East, looked to the United States as not being an empire. They really did look to the United States as being something different, and they had been occupied by Western countries, whether it was the Dutch colonies or German colonies or British colonies or French colonies, and they really saw the United States as something that was a desirable ally. And that was one of the reasons why the United States had such an easy time getting into those places. It was because of the way America was viewed during that time. And just remember, too, that up until World War II, the United States really didn't have a very large or substantial military, or even, for that matter, a foreign policy establishment. The United States was very kind of, it was partially isolationist. There were a lot of people in this country who didn't really feel as if they should be drawn, the United States should be drawn into international conflicts, should be drawn into the world, the world of warfare that that the Europeans had been going through for 1,000 years. And so as a result of that, what's happened is that we've almost gone through an entire turnaround since World War II, since the end of World War II. And that's the irony of this, is that this national security state was created, the Cold War was created, and when the Cold War ended, the mentality continued. And that's where the issue of the empire comes in. The empire is really in the minds of the authorities who are perpetuating solutions that just simply don't work. I mean, the comparison's been made to the United States in Vietnam to what the United States is now doing in Afghanistan. But the fact is that It is very similar. It's very similar from, it's not as similar from an Afghan point of view or from a Taliban point of view. It's similar from a Washington point of view for the simple reason that Washington does the same thing everywhere it goes.
I was going to say, I wish we had about 2 hours. The other option is for people to get the book. I think that's a better idea. Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald are my guests in the Peter Werbe Show. The book is Crossing Zero. That's the line, this sort of imaginary line. You got to remember, you know, all lines separating countries are just put forth in people's heads and then defended by men with guns. The AFPAC War at the Turning Point of the American Empire is the subtitle. It's published by City Lights Books, and I would, besides getting this book, I would go to their website, citylights.com. Invisiblehistory.com will bring you to Crossing Zero as well. But we have about 5 minutes left, and there's a lot of political questions left, a lot of economic questions, but we get at least some peak, although, as I said earlier, the AFPAC war is not on the lead item on everybody's mind, to be sure. But we do know that the United States is suffering deaths and injuries, and from time to time we hear about what the Afghan people are suffering. Quite a few years ago, 1998, the two of you were collaborating with human rights people to put out a book called Women for Afghan Women, Shattering Myths and Claiming the Future. Where is all that at now? I mean, what are the Afghan people suffering or benefiting, if you will, by the United States war there? And a little about the status of women, maybe.
I think that at this point, the Afghan people are absolutely just totally crushed in terms of, you know, when, in 2001, if you can appreciate the fact that, you know, the euphoria that was actually really present when the Taliban was driven out, many people don't realize that the Taliban really, for the Afghans, was really effectively an invading force. This was an occupation. It really has been very misunderstood, and this is something that was very, very troubling. And of course, we know the women's issue became very much the focus of in 1998 when we first got involved with Sima Wali, Refugee Women in Development. We were very focused on the crisis that Afghan women were suffering, and that became the reason the Clinton administration ultimately could not recognize the Taliban as the legitimate government of Afghanistan, because the United Nations, I believe, had actually identified what was going on in Afghanistan against women was a gender apartheid, effectively. So what ended up happening when the Taliban was then finally driven out in 2001, there was absolute, just so euphoric. The fact that 3,000 Afghans had been killed in the process was simply forgiven. It wasn't even an issue. The possibility of really beginning to reclaim the country. But then what ended up happening was the Bush administration ended up completely undermining the will of the Afghan people. Instead of allowing them to bring back the king, which is what they wanted to do, they were basically told they had to accept Karzai, who was handpicked for reasons that had to do with the political agenda of the Bush administration and little to do with him being the chosen leader for the Afghan people. This is continuing to be a problem, and Karzai really actually has put forth a lot of policies that are completely opposite the traditional progressive policies that Afghan leaders have had for women and for progress for all the people of Afghanistan. Karzai really is much more aligned with extremists and Islamists in terms of women's issues. That actually does not represent the tradition of the Afghan people at all.
Let me interrupt you just a little, because we are almost out of time, and one of the questions I'm sure is on everyone's mind. It's on mine. When and if are we, the United States, ever going to get out of Afghanistan?
What I was about to say was the fact that I think the problem with Washington and the Obama administration at this point is that the political, the strategy for what's going on has not been determined. There seems to be a division in terms of what the objectives are. Part of it wants to remain there. This isn't really an issue of the military at all. It never really is. The military is doing the best job they possibly can. The issue comes down to the fact that it would require something like 800,000 soldiers to really accomplish what they're trying to accomplish in Afghanistan, and that's not going to happen. But the policy people in Washington are the ones who have to make the decision. They have to change their policy from a Cold War policy and put some realistic agendas there. And from our perspective, if they put the interests of the Pakistani and the Afghan people ahead of all the other agendas, they'd actually be able to withdraw and secure the areas that they need to secure with the help of the population. Without the help of the population, this is an endless task. They're never going to be able to accomplish what they set out to do.
Are they attempting to establish a pipelandistan? I mean, that's one of the common things. We're there for the oil. We're there for forward bases to surround China and Iran and what have you, and that ultimately the American empire really doesn't have any business at all in that region of the world. We certainly wouldn't want China or Russia to have bases or being invading, Costa Rica or something like that.
Well, exactly, and that's what they're doing there. I mean, this is big business, and that's why the Saudis are in the oil business, and that's why the Saudis are supporting, the people that they were supporting in terms of the Taliban and the extremists, because that's the way in which they have worked their way up into South Central Asia. By radicalizing the populations of those areas.
Paul, we have 30 seconds left. I'm sorry to say, are any quick 30 seconds of can you prognosticate when and if we're going to get out of there? I know that's a tough one.
It's a very complex situation that is clearly not going to be separated very easily. And all we can see right now is that the will of the Afghan people has been ignored all along, and until they really understand what it means to listen to the people, it isn't going to change.
I want to thank both of you for being on the show again. You always open our eyes so much to what now is properly called the AFPAC War. It's our longest war. We got to start thinking about how to bring it to an end. My guests have been Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald. They've written Crossing Zero, the AFPAC War at the Turning Point of American Empire. Their website is invisiblehistory.com. I would highly recommend going to it. A link is also going to be at my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Paul, Liz, thanks for being on the broadcast.
Well, thanks so much, Peter.
Thank you, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Homeowners, the mortgage market is starting to move, but the good news is rates are still incredibly low. Don't miss this opportunity to refinance your mortgage. Call Quicken Loans at 888-249-1425. Quicken Loans is America's home loan experts, closing 1 million home loans over 25 years. And recently, J.D. Power and Associates ranked Quicken Loans highest in customer satisfaction in primary mortgage origination. Find out how quick and easy it is to refinance with Quicken Loans. Call right now for a free rate quote and see how much Quicken Loans can lower your monthly payment. Call 888-249-1425. That's 888-249-1425. For J.D. Power and Associates award information, visit jdpower.com. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. Nationwide mortgage licensing system number 3030. That's Quicken Loans, 888-249-1425. 888-249-1425.
People choose 5-Hour Energy over 7 million times a week for lots of reasons. It's a nutritional supplement that really works. Its key ingredients are available in everyday food like broccoli, bananas, and avocados. It contains about as much caffeine as a cup of the leading premium coffee, zero sugar, and 4 calories. What will be your reason for choosing 5-Hour Energy? Its effectiveness? Its beneficial ingredients? There's only one way to know. Try it today.
Individual results may vary. See 5hourenergy.com for more details.
This is your Biotech Minute. Biotechnology, a big word for an area of cutting-edge science that is improving the world we live in. In health, biotech provides breakthrough therapies and treatments for devastating diseases like cancer, MS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and HIV/AIDS. Biotechnology is also helping farmers produce more crops from existing acreage, reducing fuel use and greenhouse gas emissions, and it's creating fuels from renewable green energy sources like algae and plant waste. And this is just the beginning. The biotechnology research being done in laboratories today will improve the health and quality of our lives and our world for generations that follow. Biotechnology, helping heal, fuel, and feed the world. A public service message from this station and the Biotechnology Industry Organization. This is your Car Care Minute.
With more folks taking driving vacations this year, the pros at the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence offer the following tips to help you arrive at your destination safely. First, review your owner's manual and follow the recommended service schedules. Be certain to check the level and concentration of the cooling system. Check your tires for wear and pressure, and be sure your heating and air conditioning systems are operating efficiently. If you've been experiencing performance problems such as hard starts, rough idling, or stalling, now's the time to have your vehicle serviced by a certified automotive technician. It's extra insurance against an annoying breakdown while on vacation. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com.
It's amazing how great your home looks with new carpet or flooring, especially when you get an amazing value from a company you trust. That's why you should call Sears Flooring. With Sears Flooring, you'll save 20% right now. Just call 1-888-491-3939, and Sears Flooring will bring the showroom to you. Sears has a wide range of carpet, tile, hardwood, or laminate to match your style and budget. Your new flooring will be precisely installed, and your satisfaction is guaranteed. So call Sears Flooring for a free in-home consultation. You'll save 20%. Call 1-888-491-3939. Hurry, offer ends soon. Not available in all areas. Installation provided by Sears authorized licensed contractors. License information available upon request. Call Sears Flooring now and save 20%. Call 1-888-491-3939. 1-888-491-3939. Sears.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. And if you've checked out what's the highest grossing film this last week, it was Rango. Some lizard, cowboy, action-packed. Most of the films out there are of that nature because people mostly go to the movies to be entertained. We want to get excited. We want to cry. We want to laugh and what have you. And we often don't like to have reality smack us in the face. And yet, there's some harsh realities out there that deserve to be looked at. And what if we could put that all together? Have a film that had, that was action filled, that had pathos, that had family, that had defeat and victory, and was a documentary. Well, it's a film that's going to be opening at the Royal Oak Theater in Maine, coming up very soon, Friday, March 18th, and it's called Budros. And it's the name of a town in Palestine. And as we know, that's an area of great conflict. This is a documentary. And we have with us Ronit Avni. She's the producer and the executive producer of the film. And she's directed and produced a number of incredible documentaries. And she's the executive director of an organization called Just Vision. It's justvision.org. You can look that up when you have time. But right now I'd like to bring Ronit Avni to the microphone. She's at her office in Washington, D.C., at the offices of Just Vision. Ronit, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's great to be here.
Yeah, and this film, I mean, I oftentimes, like when we're interviewing a novelist, we don't want to tell the outcome. This has some content to it that's unusual. Usually we think of the situation in Israel and Palestine and occupied Palestine as an intractable one. In fact, it's been my experience in talking with people that has said that you don't have a dog in the fight, which is a terrible analogy. I realize that oftentimes people think the Israelis are pretty mean and the Palestinians are pretty crazy. And they're sort of the Semitic cousins that are fighting one another over land, and there's just nothing that can be done about it. And it always turns violent. Tell us about Budros. First,
sure.
Tell us what the title refers to.
So Budros is the name of a village in the West Bank. It's a Palestinian village, and in 2003, the village was facing its potential destruction, the loss of its lands and the livelihood and fabric of the community that inhabited this small town of about 1,500 people. At the time, the Israeli government was building the separation barrier primarily through the West Bank. This story we're all very familiar with. That was in the news, that they were building this barrier. Israeli Israelis claim that it was for security and Palestinians claim that it was for land grab. And Boudris was right in the fault line of this planning and of this debate. And the community, one father in particular, a man by the name of Ayad Morar, decided that he wanted to do something about it. He didn't want to stand by and watch his community erode. And so he organized the men of the village, all of the political factions, Fatah, Hamas, in a nonviolent strategy. And they took to the streets and they took to the fields trying to protect their lands unsuccessfully. And then along comes his 15-year-old daughter, Iltizam. And she, in typical 15-year-old fashion, goes up to her dad and says, you know, Dad, where are all the women? And her father, to his credit, turned to her and said, well, if you want women, then you should go ahead and organize them. And so she does. And she organizes the women of the village, and then they move to the front lines, and soon internationals and Israeli activists start to join them, quite literally putting their bodies on the line, not unlike much of the imagery we've been seeing out of Egypt and Tunisia in the last few months. So it's a story of people coming together across very unlikely divides. It's a story of the power of nonviolence. I don't want to give the film away, but it is a very unique story in the context and history of this conflict and this struggle and in the history of the occupation. And it's a story of ordinary people having a lot more power than they originally think. And we thought that it was an important story to tell, particularly because nobody knew the outcome of Boudris. Some of the leading journalists at the time documented the demonstrations as they were unfolding, but no one bothered to go back and find out what happened. No one bothered to find out whether they were successful or not and why. And so this film has helped to both celebrate the power of nonviolence and of people coming together with the power and agency that they have, and also to examine a historical moment that has tremendous significance and yet went largely unnoticed.
I suspect that a couple of things you said struck people as unusual. First, nonviolence. We don't think of that as a region that is typified by that kind of tactics. Usually when we think of Palestinian resistance to Israeli occupation, we see it with force of arms, bombs, and suicide bombers in the past and what have you. And the other thing is the participation of Israelis alongside of Palestinians. Could you explain both of those a little?
Absolutely. I think this film defies a lot of stereotypes. It was very interesting for us when we toured with our first film in Counterpoint back in 2006. Among Israeli audiences, as we showed the film, they would often say, you know, where is the Palestinian nonviolence movement? And then they would claim that and assert that if Palestinians adopted nonviolence, there would be peace. And at the same time, when we would take the film to Palestinian society, they would say, we've tried nonviolence and it failed, referring to the First Intifada, which was largely characterized by marches and strikes and boycotts and sit-ins and other forms of nonviolent resistance. But, you know, there was a huge gap in perception. So for Israelis, the First Intifada, and I think in the West, I think in America too, our imagery was of, you know, Molotov cocktails, of the stabbing of collaborators, of stone throwing. It wasn't of women leading marches. It wasn't of people sitting in and striking and engaging in those other forms of collective nonviolent action. And Palestinians largely remember it that way and regard it as such. So Boudris is a way to challenge both of those firmly held beliefs. The idea in the Israeli collective psyche that Palestinians have never adopted nonviolence, which is not true, and the idea that nonviolence cannot yield results, which is also not true. I think that second equation is a little bit easier now that Tunisia and Egypt have happened. Regardless of what the political outcomes will be in the long term, I think no one can argue that ordinary people coming together through an unarmed process have a lot more agency and a lot more possibility than they might have imagined.
Renée Dovny is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. She is the producer and the executive producer of Boudris. It's a documentary about a nonviolent struggle in that particular town in occupied Palestine. It begins at the main theater on Friday, March 18th. And also, she is the executive director of Just Vision. We will get to that in a little while as well. Their website is justvision.org. Now, as you say, the events with the Israelis trying to build a wall that would have destroyed all these olive groves would have been right next to a Palestinian school would have done great damage to this very old Palestinian town. But it began in 2003. I mean, how did you hook into? In other words, were you there right from the beginning, or did you depend on footage that had been taken back then?
That's a very good question. Our office at the time, our team was based in East Jerusalem in Sheikh Jarrah at the time, and I had actually been active in a village that preceded Bujus called Masha, which unfortunately was not able to save its lands, but was the first village where people came together but did not have a successful strategy for preventing the destruction of farmland. So we were very aware, and others in my team, Rula Salameh, who's a Palestinian journalist based in the region, of course, we're very aware of events going on. But in 2003, we were actually shooting our first film, Encounter Point. And so, no, we were not embarking on this film project at the time. We decided to make Boudreaux several years later in 2007. And initially, we thought that it was going to be a short film. But as we began our research, we discovered that, in fact, there was always a camera present. There was always an activist holding a camera, someone that was trying to deter human rights abuses, somebody who was trying to document the situation on the ground, perhaps to use as evidence in a court or tribunal, or because they felt it was a historic moment. And we were very fortunate that throughout the entire period, even though it was never the same person, there was always a camera present. And so a lot of our work was tracking down about 100 hours of footage. We ended up using approximately 12 different sources of materials from people in Sweden and the United States and England, and also two Israeli activists who happened to be professional filmmakers. So we were very fortunate in terms of the quality of footage that they shot. And then, of course, we went back and we did a lot of the research. We conducted our own interviews and shot about 100 hours of our own footage. And so the film is a combination of archival and our own internal contemporary footage, and it weaves it together. And one of the reasons why we decided to make the film was not just to be a look back at a historical moment in time. There are many other villages in Palestinian society facing the same circumstances that Boudreaux faced. And so this wasn't just a look back. This is also an examination of what are the options, what are the possibilities, what is happening that is an outgrowth of events in Boudreaux on the ground today. And the film is serving as a catalyst for those conversations today in Palestinian society, in Israeli society, and internationally.
I think you know full well, being a documentary filmmaker, that getting commercial distribution of documentaries is unusual. In many ways, Michael Moore really opened the floodgates of the ones that we've seen lately. One of in fact, I've even heard it now discussed openly, if you will, that in order to meet the standards of commercial release, they have to be at least an hour and 20 minutes, which Boudreaux is. And I start, my interest often starts to flag at about 60 minutes. It didn't with this one. This was, even some of Michael Moore's, I thought, went through okay to the end. Others, yeah, Michael, I get it. But this, as I said at the beginning, is so action-packed and so dramatic, and the footage of this conflict between Israeli soldiers and nonviolent Palestinians is so compelling that I think it really held very easily the interest of the viewer right through. Am I correct in my, I mean, I know you think I'm correct in my assessment that it's compelling, and it is, but the idea is that you just can't make an hour documentary.
We were very clear that we were only going to make a film that warranted the, you know, and as I mentioned, initially we thought we were going to make a short film, and then we saw that the power of the footage was so incredible that it did in fact deserve to have a little bit more time. And so we gave it that space. And you know, it is funny that a lot of people do come out saying that didn't feel like a documentary, that felt like an action movie, you know. And even my husband said that to me the first time he saw it, and he meant it as a compliment, and I took it that way. You know, the director of the film, Julia Basha, wrote and edited the film Control Room. And when that came out in 2004, that was one of the highest grossing documentaries of all time. Certainly Michael Moore has surpassed that exponentially. But that was also a very gripping, very riveting film. And Julia's an incredibly talented storyteller. We were able to get access to Verite footage. You know, sometimes you're right in the thick of the action. You're running with with activists, you're running with soldiers, you see multiple points of view, multiple perspectives. So definitely we wanted the viewer to immerse themselves. We also wanted people to feel like they could see this film on a Saturday night, even if they had no connection to the issue, and they just wanted to see a really good movie. And, you know, we've been very fortunate that the film festivals have been celebrating the film as a work of art, as a piece of storytelling, as something dynamic and compelling. And it happens to have a social theme, and it happens to be a documentary. But first and foremost for us is a commitment to quality and quality storytelling. And hopefully that comes across for people.
Well, I want to say that Control Room, which I would indicate another must-see film, is kind of grim. And yet, and when you mentioned about seeing Boudreaux on a Saturday night, I don't want to give it all away, but you don't, I'll give you this much, you don't leave feeling badly and angry. I mean, the human content of it is inspiring, to say the least. The film is Boudreaux. And it's going to open on Friday, March 18th at the main theater in Royal Oak. On Thursday, March 24th at the main, Rebecca Abou-Shadin is going to be there following the 7:15 show to do a Q&A on all of this. And my guest, Ronit Avni, is the executive director of JustVision.org. Now, we were talking before our interview that you have joined American, Israeli, and Canadian citizenship.
Yes.
So, I mean, when you know, I don't know what they think when you're at the airport and you start shuffling around for passports.
But, I know.
But one of the
many bad jokes about it.
One of the questions actually that I asked that went unanswered was when I was talking about the unusual facets of the struggle in Boudreaux, and that was about the presence of Israelis. And you, as an Israeli, were you born in Israel or born here or Canada?
I was born actually in Montreal. My father is Israeli and lives in Israel. My mm-hmm. sister was born in Israel. My mother's Canadian, and my father moved back to Israel when I was a teenager, and then I would go back and forth and eventually live there for a number of years. So, but my early childhood was certainly spent in Canada, but I am a mutt.
Well, that's the best kind. But so you were in Israel when there were suicide bombers.
Yes.
There, and I've talked to people, like a friend of mine lost a relative who was a member of in a suicide bombing of Peace Now. So the suicide bombers, the targets are indiscriminate. That was the impetus for building the wall for security to not allow penetration of suicide bombers into Israel. And you see that when the debate takes place, that the Palestinians are these inherently violent people that are going to continue this reign of terror unless we're able to shut them out. And so, as someone who's part Israeli and Israeli father, I mean, how do you sort that all out in your mind? Justice for the Palestinians, security for the Israelis?
Yeah, you know, it's a much more complicated issue than I think we often have it framed for us. So it's more complex than just security versus human rights. And also, I should say, my professional background is in the realm of human rights. So I come to this work through a human rights lens, which ultimately values, you know, individuals equally, regardless of their ethnic and national and religious backgrounds. But, you know, it's interesting. In the process of researching the film, we interviewed one of the initial proponents of building the barrier in the first place, a decorated Israeli military veteran named Shaul Arieli. And his initial rationale for wanting to build it was to separate the two societies, de-escalate the conflict, and return to the negotiating table. And interestingly, when he saw the path that was being proposed by the Sharon government, he and a group of other decorated Israeli war veterans took the Israeli government to court. And an exact quote of his at the time when I conducted this interview with him was, "Security was sacrificed on the altar of the settlements." And in the case of their particular court case, it was called the Beit Zurik case, they actually won in that specific instance. It does not relate to Boudreaux. But in that instance, the military and the government changed and rerouted the path of the barrier to be much more aligned with the Green Line, the internationally recognized armistice line. So even in that, you know, it's almost a false choice to say security versus human rights. I actually think that the two are deeply intertwined, and that ultimately the well-being of both societies is going to be contingent upon the respect for the human rights of both communities. And so I think it's short-sighted for us to trample on anybody's rights in the process, whether it's Israeli civilians in terms of a suicide bombing or whether it's Palestinians that are facing collective punishment as a result of sieges and barriers and things like that. So it is a very complex. I don't claim to be representative of any population. I'm really speaking on my own behalf. But, you know, our work takes into account the humanity of both societies. We don't want to dehumanize anybody. I don't think it serves any good to do that. And also there are incredible acts of courage going on among ordinary civil society, people willing to put their bodies on the line, both Palestinian and Israeli. And you see that in Budrus. It trades off times where the Palestinians protect the Israeli activists from the military and times where the Israeli activists are protecting the Palestinian villagers. And to me, that dynamic of real partnership, of real recognition of the humanity of the other, while doing something proactive to change the structural dynamics on the ground, is something that does give me hope and is very moving to me. So, you know, I don't necessarily put a lot of faith in the political leadership at the moment, but I think that we can't afford to abandon those people in both societies who reflect those values, who recognize the intrinsic worth of every individual and of pluralism and of the need to find a way out of this incredible mess. So, you know, and I think that's a lot of the work that Just Vision does. Our organization is really about researching and documenting these stories and making sure that that journalists and thought leaders and community leaders know about this work so that we don't cede all of the space to the militants and militarists.
You know, you mentioned the Israeli activists and yourself as having Israeli citizenship. And at one point, there's a television interview. It was, could have been with the Minister of the Interior. I don't know what.
The Deputy Defense Minister.
Okay, and yeah. They mentioned something. I don't know if he was on the same show or what, but with an Israeli activist who was part of the nonviolent resistance
that
the Palestinians in Budrus were putting forth. And he said, that guy should be arrested, very ominously. So I guess, and maybe I'm not asking this directly enough, how is a film like Budrus, how are the Israeli activists that line up on, if you will, on the side of the Palestinians viewed? Or even, you know, if this isn't too personal, you might even add in how your father looks
my
at you.
My family is, they've been very supportive. I think that they, like many people, don't necessarily believe that ordinary people who aren't in government have much power. So I think that their skepticism has less to do with the politics of it and more to do with, you know, what can we do as ordinary people if we're not in government? What role do we have to play? I think that's the, you know, understandable skepticism that I face in my family and community, and certainly that my colleagues in their respective families and communities face. It's very interesting because the film Budrus has been extremely well received in Israel. We've gotten terrific press from a wide range of media outlets, not just the left-leaning outlets. You know, Channel 2 News did a five-minute segment where they actually came to our Ramallah premiere. We had this sold-out 800-person Ramallah premiere, and they aired this terrific segment about the film an hour before the final game of the World Cup, which is the most widely watched, obviously, evening on television in the region. And so most Israelis were watching that night, and it was the main news piece. I was interviewed on Army Radio. I mean, we won a prize at the Jerusalem International Film Festival and actually screened the film in every Israeli cinematheque, which are these independent art house cinemas, from Sderot, which is next to Gaza, all the way up to Rosh Pina. So the reception, you know, sometimes we'll have people in the audience who have a hard time. Every once in a while we'll have a heckler, but overwhelmingly people are used to the imagery of uprising, of Israeli occupation, of repression. Those are the images that they're accustomed to. What they aren't accustomed to are seeing people like Yildizam or Ayed or Ahmed Awad, the Hamas leader, who are talking about unarmed strategies, who are welcoming Israelis, who are working together. I mean, these are things that they haven't seen before, and it opens up a lot of debate about what is the nature of a nonviolent movement or a resistance movement and what is an appropriate response to it. At the same time, the activists on the ground are facing crackdowns in Israeli society. So I don't want to paint too rosy a picture. So Kobi, who's in the film, and others like Kobi have served jail sentences. Many of them are I won't say driven into bankruptcy, because many of them don't have means to begin with, but are facing very stiff fines or sentences, a lot of repression, a lot of ostracism, and yet this movement, interestingly, is starting to grow. So we're now seeing in the last few years what started as these kind of fringe activists in Israeli society who were going into the West Bank at the height of the Second Intifada to put their bodies on the line alongside Palestinians who were leading these movements. I want to make that clear that these were Palestinian-led nonviolent struggles. And yet we're starting to see that in Sheikh Jarrah, which is in East Jerusalem, where our Just Vision office is located, where suddenly East Jerusalem is a place that Israelis can get to and are a little bit more comfortable traveling to than they are going into the West Bank, and so, or going into, you know, places like Ramallah and the villages. And so you're seeing more of the center left of Israeli society starting to show up for similar demonstrations in East Jerusalem. People like David Grossman, people who are members of parliament, a lot of the activists bring their parents, and then their parents bring their friends, and then their friends bring their relatives. And so you have a different demographics and generations than you might have seen in Budrus. So, you know, there are these concurrent trends. I think on the one hand, it's growing. It's still small. On the other hand, I think the government, threatened by this growth, is cracking down. And yet, when people are exposed to the story on its own terms of understanding where someone like Ayad or Iltisam comes from in doing what they're doing, they've been very receptive to the story.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the broadcast. Yeah, we were going to talk about Just Vision, your organization. We're completely out of time. You can see all the information on that at justvision.org. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. My guest has been Ronit Avni. She's both the producer and the executive producer of Budrus. It's a documentary about a nonviolent struggle in occupied Palestine. It begins at the main theater in Royal Oak on Friday, March 18th. There'll be a special showing on Thursday, March 24th at the Main, and following the 7:15 showing, that Rebecca Abushani will be in there to answer questions from the audience. Thank you so much for being on the broadcast.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
If you think of yourself as a technical person and want to pursue a career in technology, get started by calling ITT Technical Institute. At ITT Tech, you can develop knowledge and skills to pursue opportunities in a variety of career fields. Fields like electronics technology, information technology, and drafting and design. Call 800-741-5123. Thousands of graduates have launched new careers after attending the ITT Techs nationwide. Classes and day or evening courses meet at convenient times and teach skills used in the workplace. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career services are available for graduates. Make a technology degree program part of who you are. Call ITT Technical Institute for more information. Call right now. 800-741-5123. 800-741-5123. That's ITT Tech. 800-741-5123.
Who's watching your home when you're not there? Protect your home with a security system monitored by ADT, the leader in home security. Just call Protect Your Home, your authorized ADT dealer. Call now and get $850 of hardware and activation for free. Call 1-877-653-8844. That's 1-877-653-8844. $99 installation charge. 36-month monitoring agreement at $35.99 per month. Call for terms and conditions and Protect Your Home license number.
My dad is my hero. He goes into burning buildings. He finds people inside who need to be saved. He helps them get out, even when he can't breathe or see or is a little scared. My dad is a firefighter, but the best thing he can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration reminds you to protect yourself and firefighters. Have smoke alarms on every level and near sleeping areas. Test them monthly. Change batteries as instructed. Install sprinklers. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, most fire deaths occur in homes with no working smoke alarms. The good news is, that's a fact we can change. Smoke alarms save lives. Find out more at usfa.dhs.gov.
Water is all around us. No wonder it's hard to imagine we're facing a water crisis. But we are. So that's why the American Planning Association brings you simple ways to save water at home and in your community. Learn more at planning.org. That's planning.org. A public service message from this station and the American Planning Association.
How do you prepare for jobs involving electronics technology, drafting and design, or information technology? Call ITT Technical Institute. Develop knowledge and skills that you could use to pursue many opportunities in promising career fields. At ITT Tech, classes meet just a few days a week, and financial aid is available for those who qualify. Call ITT Tech now for more information. 800-741-5123. That's 800-741-5123.
It's Wednesday evening from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Hooters on Gratiot and 14 Mile in Roseville. Hooters is your cure for basketball fever. Enjoy drink specials, great food, and register to win plenty of Riff prizes.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit, the Motor City's rock station since 1971.
Resistance is futile.
101 WRIF.